Hey.
Hey.
You like hockey?
You like hockey?
This is a big important game.
This is a big important game.
Cut the crap.
Cut the crap.
I'm being serious. Don't do that.
I'm being serious. Don't do that.
How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? That's what I thought. Shut up! Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. I'm your host and curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator and host companion, Sijan Sarawik. Sijan?
Thank you, Devin. I'm very happy to be here today, and I'm very happy that we can finally present an episode for the whole family. A true family classic. So invite the kids to sit around the radio, as it were, as we light up your night.
I would like to ask if that means that you'll be using family-friendly language this episode, Sijan, because in the past we've tried it, and you failed miserably. I need to break the character for this moment. Oh, okay. When you say it's family-friendly, I mean...
Yeah, the movie is, not the episode.
The movie is family-friendly.
I'm falling a little bit into Delilah, so we needed to stop sooner than later. I'm not going to lie.
Turn on your hot light. I don't know why you would request Heartlight
for
Neil Diamond, but Delilah did.
But we're finally doing it, Dev.
We are finally doing it. What we're finally doing is a season for the fans. Season four is for the fans. And even before...
That's right. We're very creative. You can all stop clapping at home. It's okay.
I wonder... I mean, first of all, here's the thing about being a podcaster. You get podcast brain. I don't remember.
I love it when he sets up Seinfeld-style builds. Come on, Dad.
I don't remember really any of the things that we talk about. So there's a very good chance that at some point in this podcast, or more than likely the Say Report, which is the other podcast we do, that's more of an everything situation, not hyper-focused on one topic like the films of Adam Sandler, that we have revealed the grand design behind the theme so far to the seasons of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast.
You mean the overarching theme?
The overarching theme, yes.
The eventual Thanos of this podcast. I don't know if we've really gotten into it.
I don't know if we have, but I need to say, if anybody at home had inklings or like ideas about what we were trying to do so far, season four being for the fans is the thing that should unlock your entire corkboard.
Oh, man. We decided that we were going to kind of get to those ones that we, I mean, two qualifications. It's the movies we have not done yet, which is always kind of the biggest one for us. And then the second one was, but people keep thinking we probably have. Like, which one was your Big Daddy episode? No, we haven't done a Big Daddy episode.
Oh, Big Daddy. No, we haven't done that yet. We covered Just Go With It. You want to listen to our Just Go With It episode? We have a Jack and Jill episode that you'll probably really enjoy.
That's okay. I'll wait on the Big Daddy episode. Thanks, though.
Right. And I don't know if it's because we're consummate professionals or I'm just so stubbornly attached to a joke that I as soon as somebody said to me, Big Daddy, and it happened a lot. Big Daddy is one of those things that I heard many, many times from people when I told them I do an Adam Sandler podcast.
And there's a reason for that, and we'll talk about it when we get kind of towards the big like debate about this movie, the big debate, the 2 seconds in which we realize we've agreed the whole time. But at the end of this, where we talk about this movie, we'll talk about why this movie is probably the first one that comes to people's minds.
Yeah, the big debate ski. In the Big Dad ski. I don't know. That's what my mom's like. Say these words next,
Devin. That's Devin's title.
I don't know what's happening tonight. I don't know what we're going to do.
No, but we can't go down this road. This is not the same road.
No, it's not the same road. You're very right. And I want to get back on topic. I have my tie on. And it's one of those situations, though, where, like, Big Daddy... I mean, even this past Sunday when I went out to lunch with people and I told them I had to go eventually to record, and they're like, oh, you're Adam Sandler one. So these people knew I did an Adam Sandler podcast. And then the invariable follow-up is, Big Daddy, are you guys finally doing Big Daddy? It's like, yes, we're finally doing Big Daddy. I guess you can start listening now, 21 episodes in. I don't.
Oh, man. But
Excuse me.
thank you, Korea, for listening all along. Really,
Yeah.
seriously.
No, it's appreciated. But yeah, it is. It's the Big Daddy time, and it's for the fans. Specifically, this one is for the fans. This is for every single person who has ever said to me, "Big Daddy episode? Oh, you must love Big Daddy." These are for you. And if I could remember who said these things to me, I don't know if I would name check you personally because there's the privacy issue of it. Do you really want your name out there with the podcast? But it is. This is for you. And we hope that you enjoy it because in a lot of ways, I feel like this might be the missing link to a lot of what we're trying to do here on this show. And what is it we're trying to do here on this show? I'm glad I asked. We, Seijin and I, are attempting to put together our own personal, completely unauthorized star chart of the Adam Sandler shared cinematic universe of films.
Yeah, how do you travel from planet to planet, and what is actually around, and what maybe is in a, another dimension, as
What's
it
in a
were?
parallel universe? What's in a pocket dimension? What would be a cute cameo if there were ever a League of Adam Sandler movies, but might not necessarily make the most amount of sense? I
And why
love
does
you, Howard
Bradley?
Ratner, and I would love to see you bet on Stan Sugarman's game with the Celtics or the Phillies, but you're dead in Uncut Gems. Spoilers for Uncut Gems.
Bradley Whitford like felt like he was going to be the Loki of this series when this whole thing started, but he's really kind of turned more into, well, any other villain.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I don't think there are any grander villains. I mean, Eric Gordon is a dick. Eric Gordon is definitely the inciting action of everything, but he's not the Thanos of this. It might actually be Adam in a wig who's the Thanos of our cinematic universe. Who knows? And what of multiverses? You know, the hot new pop culture trend that people are following because it's easier to focus on entertainment about various versions of our current present than like time travel stories about the past or potential future.
Or, focus on our actual present.
Yeah, exactly. Man, wouldn't it be great? It's like the West Wing syndrome all over again. But I'm not Josh. I can't think of his last name, so I don't know why I brought him up.
I don't know what you're doing now. Again, this is not the Sea Report.
It's not
Back
the
on
same.
track.
Well, yeah. Well, you brought up Bradley Whitford, and I was gonna bring up the other guy. He played in a Scandal. He was the thing big. He was introduced in Sports Night. Never mind. It's not important. I'm sure it will come to me.
I'm still
Josh
like
Molina.
flounder on this.
Josh Molina is his
There we
name,
go.
and I had to get it out to
Who
get back on track.
recently revealed how much he didn't really care for the West Wing.
Right, despite having done the West Wing Weekly podcast. And it all comes back together. But yeah, you say Bradley Whitford, I'm going to go West Wing. And it makes sense with everything we're doing. But yeah, that's it. So Hubie Halloween came along, and there was all these murmurings of, oh, is there a shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films? And rather than Seijin and I doing what we, not that we would normally do, but what people in that situation tend to do, being like, of course there's a shared cinematic universe, we decided to approach it as a teachable moment and go through the filmography of Adam Sandler, 80 credits in all as of today's recording, and determine what films do fit together
Yeah, see,
in certain ways.
I see as more like, I guess you could call us the Indiana Jones of Adam Sandler movies, because I also see is that you're right that we have brought it here to teach people what we have found, right? But we are going out there and doing the actual archaeology to figure it out. We're not going into these movies, especially now. In our first season, we had a little bit of a mission to prove that things actually did have a bit of a bias. But since that first season, we have made it a point that we don't go into any one of these movies thinking that they definitely fit. We go in wondering if they do, right? And we go in and we go looking for clues. We dust off some of these old dusty jokes and see if they still work or not. And even if they don't, we try and figure out how they might have worked at the time. But we don't always succeed. I don't even think they knew what they were doing then for a lot of these jokes. But yeah, this idea being that we explore these movies with the mindset that like this may or may not be one of those ones that fits into this larger picture of like the world of Adam Sandler. And it's been an experiment so far. But these are kind of the ones. What's going to be interesting about doing the ones for the fans, these are kind of the ones that you bring the bias to. The audience comes and says, well, you have to do this one because it's obviously in, right? Or you have to talk about this one because it's so far from what his usual stuff is. Like there's that kind of back and forth with these particular movies. And so that'll be really interesting because Again, we're trying really hard to approach these movies, not assuming one way or the other. But it'd be hard to deny that when people come to us and bring these specific movies to us, it's because they have an opinion already about them, right?
Yeah, it's because you say I do a shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler podcast, and they're like, "Oh, so Big Daddy, right? Like that's gotta be where it starts." And it's like, "Well, funny you should mention that."
Well, yeah, I mean, and there's good reason for that being your first reaction. There's a lot going on in this movie that is very Sandlery. The people that are there, the ways in which they're there, the jokes that are on display, the ways in which story is important but also quite absurd. There's a lot going on in this movie that we're treading a lot of old ground when we come back to Big Daddy Dev.
Yes, and that's also one of the reasons why.
Comma, Dev.
Oh,
Just want to establish there was a comma in that
that is not
sentence.
Big Daddy Dev. You're not
No,
calling me
just
Big Daddy Dev.
there was a comma in that sentence. Go ahead.
If you want to start calling me Big Daddy Dev, though, Seijin just coined it as a nickname.
I almost spit up my beer. What are you doing?
But yeah, so that's what we're doing here. And the way that we kick off every episode when we're talking about one of these films, and specifically one that starts a season, right? These season starters tend to be ones where people are jumping on to our transportation module through the universe for the first time. So welcome.
And yeah, and you tend to do something that's not very creative, kind of expected, but it's okay because that comforting entrance into the new story is important, right?
Yes, exactly. You give kind of all of the characters a little bit of an exposition dump so that you understand who they are. Devin the crazy esoteric one, Seijin the put upon every man who's wearing a blue collar right now, I'm sure. And that's sort of what the show is. But the way that we try to kick it off after reestablishing what our mission objective is here at the ASCU is by sharing our first impressions of this film. So are you able to go back to 1999 to when you first saw this movie, Seijin?
Yeah, so 1999, I would have probably seen this movie. I probably saw it in theaters, like dropped off to hang out with my friends. Not dropped off on a date. I think we've talked about that night, right? Like the idea of like the drop off on the date situation, and that's a very different
If
vibe.
we haven't, there's a movie with Adam Sandler that I can't wait to talk about. But that's
But
season
the
five or further.
yeah, we but that concept of the being dropped off to hang out with your friends at the you know the, this wouldn't have been the dirt theater probably at this point because I didn't hang out in that part of town until I got into high school and met the Rumford guys, and so that was why I would have been down that way. So instead, this probably would have been like one of the cinemas near me. The Showcase used to be this area between Rhode Island and Mass, and there was this part of Route 6 that I don't ex know ex I don't think it existed in either, right? But there was a Showcase Cinemas on one side, and there was a Showcase Cinemas on the other. One was like a six screen and one was like a three screen. And the three screen one was always the one where like the smaller movies, the more like the ones that they didn't expect to do really well were. And then the big one was where everything else was, right? And so I probably was at the big one for this. I mean, it was an Adam Sandler movie a few years into his career, and he was, it was not unexpected that it was huge. And so I got dropped off with some friends, went in to go see this movie, and enjoyed the hell out of it, and subsequently saw it like two or three more times by bringing family and things like that. But one of the big things about this movie is that I've talked, I think, when we talked about Happy Gilmore way back in the first season. Happy Gilmore had this really weird thing in my life nostalgically because for some reason, I will never understand. Bless the woman's soul. My grandmother loved that fucking movie. We rented it once when I was like spending the weekend at her house, and we watched it like three times in one weekend, and she thought it was hilarious. Like, we loved that movie. So when Big Daddy came around, I knew instantly the first person I wanted to watch this with when I could get it at home was my grandmother. And I do remember that. I remember watching this movie with her. So, like, I enjoyed this movie many times and, like, was excited to rewatch it with, like, specific people in my life. This might be one of the first movies where I really kind of have that story. Because I only would have been, like, 10 or 11, right? But the idea that I was, like, my mom and dad were handing me $20. They were probably staying at the movie theater. I don't remember that part, but there's no way that they were just leaving me alone. But me and my friends definitely went in to go see this movie on our own. And then my parents probably went to go see like Notting Hill or whatever the hell else was out that at that time. And then like we you know and then and I remember like very much enjoying this movie with me and my friends being doofy, and then very much enjoying this movie subsequently with my grandmother. Like, so I got some very fond memories of this movie. Now, that being said, it's one of the rare ones that I think because I enjoy it and I know it is such a a risky watch in some ways because of the whole Adam Sandler of it. Like, we've talked about how there is that weird feeling we all seem to have about, like, the dangers of watching an Adam Sandler movie, even one you've seen before, but you're like, yeah, but if I'm not remembering, like, a specific thing that's going to just ruin my day, I don't know if I really want to put this one on, like The Wedding Singer. And then inevitably there's the scene with the crossdresser, right? No, that's The Waterboy, right?
Well, there's a crossdresser in both of those movies.
Yeah, well, there you
but
go.
One of them is a character who is developed, not as fully developed as George should be. Yeah. But then the crossdressing in Waterboy is played more for the
lulls.
That's the
one where it's Clint Howard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. Yeah. Like, you put on Waterboy thinking, I remember what a great movie this was, and like, it's PG-13. Well, fuck it, let's watch it. And then you get to that stuff and you just cringe, right? Mm-hmm. So that idea, the cringe factor, right? Mm-hmm. It stops me from watching it every year, but I sure as hell have come back to it every few years. I mean, I own it on DVD, so like, it's not like I've gotten rid of it in many of my cullings of DVDs. I know that I want to watch it again, but I'm not always quick to put it on. So when I do, it's kind of a joyous surprise, and then I kind of stay away from it for a little bit of time.
Excellent. Well, I'm happy to have filled your cup up with Big Daddy with the watching of this episode.
Just gonna keep happening, folks. And to be fair, it's weird in the movie too, like Sandler being like this father figure, and like, and the movie acknowledges it, right? Like, it's but the daddy jokes and the daddy comments and the weird 35-year-old father figurely nonsense that's happening here is all through the movie as well as this episode.
Excellent. So for my first impressions, I don't know if I've ever really dipped into the fact that for the first, let's see, I was 6 years old until I was, 25. So let's say 20 years of my life I spent as a trailer checker. And if you don't know what a trailer checker is, it is the person who goes in, watches the trailers, gauges the audience's reaction, and then sends that information off to a marketing firm. And what the trailer checker gets for that is like $8.50 per movie that they do that for, and they get to see the movie for free. And that is something that my family did for at least 20 years. And the only reason we stopped is because they stopped letting you watch the movie for free. They made you buy a ticket to do this.
They better be paying you more than $8.50.
Yeah, exactly. You might as well. It would be very nice if they would recompensate you for the ticket and, you know, something on top of it. But no, that was no longer the case. It was one of those situations where the movie theaters understood that trailer checkers are important to make sure that the trailers that are being shown before the movies are going to get people to come back to the theater. And I actually think that one of the reasons why this whole job ceased was the rise of YouTube culture and the fact that you had a like-dislike for any trailer out there. You didn't need a person in the theater, in that environment, judging if it had a positive, negative, or no reaction from your audience.
Once again, the internet ruining everything.
That's what the internet's for, Sejin. You can look up the menu at the McDonald's. If Sonny had gone on the internet, he wouldn't have known. He would have known that breakfast stops at 10:30.
Or he would have found one that did all day breakfast nowadays. But
not in 99. That did not happen in 99. But it's one of those situations. And the reason why I bring that up is, first of all, those two theaters that existed in essentially the gym from West Side Story, it's neutral ground, you see. It was an 8-screen theater and a 2-screen theater because it was the Seekonk 10. And for some reason, we trailer checked there as well. and so I know that. And I also know that because we used to have to count seats and there were all other ways to get bonus revenue from doing this. The only reason that I bring up my trailer checking days now is because Big Daddy is a film that I saw as a trailer checker with the entire family. Really wild west of the cinema in the 90s.
Yeah.
Pre like 2001. And what happened on September 11th, we would kind of just let people do whatever they wanted. They would let a whole family walk into trailer check when, like, the paperwork said, let in this one person.
I mean, we gave a lot less shit back
yeah.
then. You're not wrong. Some might say that's what led to some of the later issues.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, you get complacent.
Intelligence pointing to a terrorist attack on this exact date? Nah. Yeah, we're not getting into that.
We're not getting into that with this movie. Maybe somewhere down the line. Maybe as a fan favorite. Who knows?
Maybe when we do Reign Over Me, but
yes,
not
that's
today.
That's what I was... Thank you, Sijin, for cutting through it. Anywho, so I saw it as a trailer check with my entire family, which means that it would have been a Friday night, and it would have been a pretty packed audience. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to that movie with the whole family, including Dale, who was the same age as the Julian character. Dylan and Cole Sprouth are 7 in real life when they make this movie, but Julian, the child, or Frankenstein, whichever name you prefer to use for him, is 5 years old, and that's how old Dale is when we go to see this movie. And, like, I sit there, I watch it, there are some memorable moments for me, but overall, this is a movie that I saw when I was 13 years old and never really was interested in going back to. Now, that brings up what might be an interesting wrinkle with this season that literally didn't occur to me until, like, 4 p.m. today when I was packing up all of my notes. Devin Decker, just as a brand, is sort of a contrarian. I got real, like, ingrown indie music syndrome, and that expands out to everything. So doing an entire season dedicated to things that specifically other people enjoy, there's going to be some more hurdles for me to clear with these movies.
Devin, I have known you for 15 years now, and I cannot believe that it didn't even occur to me. it is just part of being friends with you that I just kind of figured you'd be down on these movies.
Yeah, no, and I understand that. But, you know, what I will say, stolen from the archives of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, that's sort of how I felt about The Wedding Singer. The Wedding Singer is a movie that I saw, and then I just kind of shuffled away. And one of the main reasons was all of the other kids on the playground constantly quoted The Wedding Singer. But then when I rewatched it, I was able to find the joy and beauty of The Wedding Singer. And now, I mean, I kind of just throw that movie on as background noise. Mm-hmm. If I just want to, like, pass an hour and a half when I'm doing a speed run or something. So it's helped me get over some of my own personal biases with these films. And that's sort of what I was hoping with Big Daddy. And we'll get into it a little bit deeper, how I now feel about this particular film and the fact that it was constantly quoted. But I do remember enjoying it at the time, but it never really being something that I was, like, excited or demanding to dive back into.
Yeah, I think the wildest part, as far as, like, revisiting it goes and, like, really having to try and figure out what the mindset kind of was at the time, is how much this movie assumes Adam Sandler, outside of this movie, is one of the bad boys of comedy, right? And mm-hmm. I have a hard time seeing that as a guy that at this point in my life has seen, like, Grown Ups and Grown Ups too. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
like there's a weird disconnect in the way that this movie really wants you to view Sandler. And again, not within the movie. There's a lot to be said about how this movie wants you to view Sandler within the movie as well. But in particular, this whole movie kind of rides on you ghosting Adam Sandler. Like, oh, they're putting Happy Gilmore with kids. And, like, that worked in Billy Madison, so let's see it again, right? Like, there's this weird aspect of, like, you wanting to come and see this guy that is I think I'd be more, like, kind of on that, like, oh, this is edgier comedy if it was, like, the Jackass guys, like if they put Johnny Knoxville with a bunch of kids. But I think they made that movie too at some point, didn't they?
Made Dirty Grandpa. That's with Robert Downey Jr. No, not Robert Downey Jr. That'd be great. Robert De Niro.
But the Grandpa one.
Bad Grandpa. That's essentially Big Daddy with Johnny Knoxville, but he has to be a grandfather for it to work.
And that is a weirder, more offbeat thing, right? And this movie just wants me to think about how quirky and offbeat it is that they've put Adam Sandler with kids, knowing the whole time that they're just kind of aping what he just did with a bunch of the kids in Billy Madison. But by this point, he had really developed this persona of being, like, the guy your parents don't want you to buy the CDs for, right? This is the one that you have to, like, sneak past. Like, you got to go to the place that doesn't care that there's a parental advisory sticker on it. Like, that's the kind of comedy that he's really kind of falling into. And that doesn't really exist anymore.
Neither does Sam's Records and Tapes, where I bought all of my Adam Sandler albums. They knocked it down. I think there's, like, a halal market there now.
Yeah. Yeah,
rest
but
in peace, Mardi Gras.
It's just like, it's wild to me because like kids have access, kind of going back to the internet thing, kids have access to all of that shit now. So like, you don't really have that persona anymore. You don't have that persona where it's like, I'm aiming all this shit at the parents, but I know for a fact all my money's going to come from the kids that sneak in. Like that whole attitude is just present throughout this whole movie. And we don't have that anymore. So like, reminding yourself that that's kind of the bit throughout this entire thing is really important. And like, and I think it's hard for us, you and me in particular, because of the age that we were at, we were on the wrong side of that conversation. Like my parents' memories of this movie is probably very different than my memories of this movie, and not for the reason, not for the usual reasons.
To share memories of this movie, which is always sort of a fun thing to dip into, Dale shared her memories of this movie. Because when I said we were doing Big Daddy, she said, oh, finally, you know, that movie, I know I saw it. I remember three things. I remember him peeing on a building.
Yep, that was on a poster, but also in the movie multiple times, yep.
I remember him learning about Scuba Steve and then pretending to be Scuba Steve to get him to do what he wanted.
So far, this is tracking exactly with my normal memories of this movie. That then I get worried that I'm forgetting something and don't put it on.
Yeah,
so
that's a very good thing. And then I wish I could remember what her third one were, because those two were just like so
crying through the last
perfect.
20 minutes of it, Dale?
No, probably not crying through the last 20 minutes of it. I don't know if a five-year-old would have the emotional range and understanding to get that. I really feel like that's specifically aimed at people our age, which is the age of Sonny's character.
I mean, the balls on this movie, where they start the emotional climax of this film, like, and then they sit in it for that entire, like, from the moment that that guy comes to pick up Julian to the moment through the entire courtroom scene. Is just like just an emotional, just constant, just it's not even a punch in the gut. It's like somebody punched you in the gut, but then didn't pull back. They just left their fist there. And you're just kind of like left wondering for 20 minutes why you're in so much pain and what kind of weird shit this thing is going to do next.
I'm glad that you said all that because it triggered what the third one was for me. Him going to Hooters for a birthday party.
Nice.
Those were the three memories nice. That came from Dale as so someone who saw this movie when she was 5 years old and has not gone back to it.
Oh, shit. Him going to Hooters for a birthday party.
So
yeah.
It's like, oh, so the end of the movie, kind of the break into three of the movie. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like the first moment where you realize maybe this guy shouldn't be with a kid. But also he sort of has a point.
Yeah.
I mean, that's that whole sequence with him, like, I have to go to the bathroom. He's like, well, we're almost there. That right there is the first indication that Sonny's sort of out of his element. And the fact of the matter is, like, him saying, like, we're almost there, an actual parent would say, why don't you try to hold it till we're there, and then you can use the bathroom at McDonald's.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have that because he just got thrown into it. It's such a weird dichotomy, that scene.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this movie, Dev. So before we go any further,
I want to know if you got any facts and figures, because I think there's only one fact and or figure about this movie that is important.
I'd be interested to hear what you consider it to be. So it's $234 million is what it breaks in on a budget of only $34 million. So this is a wide success. This is a huge success, right? Now, that being said, like, you can go and see what's going on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, we kind of half joked about this earlier, but critics like pan this thing, right? But as what seems to be the case always with Sandler, even from the very beginning, this has always been the case. Critics say one thing and then audiences still just fall in love with it. So it's still riding at a 75% as far as the audience rating goes, which is, I mean, you know, that's a pretty good hit ratio for this movie, right? As far as like where it kind of falls, like in his career, just to get a feel for that, like really the only two movies before this, three movies before this are Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, and then The Wedding Singer, right?
You also have The Waterboy. Those four happened. Yeah.
Just before this, this is when we kind of get into that weird time when he's like doing like a movie a year, right?
Yeah.
Like he starts with Waterboy, then Big Daddy, then Little Nicky, then like, he just goes like fucking nuts for the next few years where he just nonstop works. And it, like we've talked about this before, not that he's slowed down much really in the last few years, a little, but not like it's crazy how much the dude like,
I mean,
does.
There was a 2021 movie that was supposed to happen, the Hotel Transylvania Transformania. And we haven't even begun to dig into it, but on some level, I have to imagine he initially planned to be a part of that film, before
Yeah, I don't
they
know.
like
It's
it's
well, because don't forget they've had like a weird TV show going for a while too. So I don't know how, and I know he's not involved in that, other than maybe as a producer. But like, so I don't know how much four out of them. Yeah, we got to talk about Hotel Transylvania someday. Like, spoiler alert, someday we're going to address the animated movie, the other animated movie, I guess I should
The
say.
animated movies.
But the idea being that, yeah, this is still pretty early in what he's doing. Although I guess with Waterboy, I guess you would call this what, sophomore, right? Like, this is like a late sophomore effort for him.
This is sort of his freshman year of college, if we're going
Okay.
to be completely honest about it. Billy Madison would be his freshman. Happy Gilmore is his sophomore. Wedding Singer, as I always say, is his junior. And somehow that everyone always says your junior year is the most important. And then Waterboy is his season year. And Waterboy does so well, and it's so surprising that they get the call on set from Sony saying, "By the way, we're upping your budget. So if you want to increase or extend anything, feel free, because we know that this is going to be profitable based on how well the Waterboy has done."
You mean on Big Daddy, on the
On
set
Big
of Big
Daddy,
Daddy.
yes.
Yeah.
They're on set
Yeah.
on Big Daddy and they get that phone call.
Well, and what's really interesting to that point is Big Daddy is a much smaller movie than we've really seen out of any of those films. Like, the majority of the sets take place in his apartment, which is a pretty, glorious apartment. And that loft is, I dream about that loft as like a place to live someday. But that idea that like that it's got the bigger budget out of other movies is really funny to me, really wild. It's probably part of the reason that you get to see so many of his friends on screen for so long, is like.
Specifically, it is why Rob Schneider and Steve Buscemi show up in more than just a single scene. The direct correlation to that additional money off of the success of Waterboy is bigger roles for Delivery Boy. I think his name is Nunzo or Nuko, and Steve Buscemi's, runaway homeless character who
Homeless
doesn't have a
guy.
name. Like,
Yeah. I mean, Rob Schneider's character is only credited as delivery guy, even though I do think they name him at some point.
Yeah,
You're
when
not
he
wrong.
after he puts him in the sleeper hold. Yeah,
Yeah, no,
so
so I
that's
mean, they get more money, but they don't run out and like do like any major like tinkering, right?
they
They just
probably
eat.
buy that surfboard in the opening. He's like, "I've always wanted a surfboard, or now we can put it on the Big Daddy budget."
Yeah.
And yeah, it's strange, but I think it's really interesting when you say that it's a smaller film, because in a lot of ways, it does feel like he's kind of going back to Billy Madison with the fact that it's him acting against a kid. It's a character who like is sort of stuck in life the same way that Billy was at the beginning of that film. And it's really interesting when you think of it as what would be his freshman year, but this time in college, how he's looking for that more familiar again.
Yeah, but there's a lot that is going on in this movie that is definitely much more mature, and I don't mean mature as in like dirty, like XXX or like, this is more adulterated than Billy Madison, not in the least. But I mean, like, there's a lot he has learned a lot by this point, right? It is a
Yes.
well-learned film, so like in a weird way, it's him taking like a second swing at that concept, right? Of the older guy surrounded by kids, like trope that he fell so nicely into in Billy Madison. Add to that though that like there's a lot more going on with other adult characters, right? There's a lot more exploration of him as an actual human in the world. Billy Madison is basically like Bugs Bunny in his world, right? Like there's the there's like a cartoonish element to everything that he does. And not to say that there isn't something like very goofy and off about Sonny in this film, but like much more down to earth and relatable character as in terms of like somebody I would probably actually meet one day.
And there's also the fact that Joey Lauren Adams' character, Layla, is actually like a fully developed character. I believe that she has a life all of her own and doesn't just exist to be in scenes with the Adam Sandler character.
All the women in this movie. I mean, Leslie Mann's character is actually explored to a level where, like, despite the fact that she is the tropey bitch best friend, she still is actually quite likable in this film. And I actually believe I understand why she would stick around when Sonny is around, right? There's always that kind of problem with that kind of character where you feel like that friend should just dump that. You're like, why is she even still involved in this whole thing? Like, and it just, she just doesn't fit. But there are wonderful moments with Leslie Mann. And let's be honest, it's because Leslie Mann knows Sandler off a set of this, right?
Yeah.
We've talked about that with the whole Judd Apatow like thing and everything with Funny People. But the way that Leslie Mann like reacts to Sonny, and she's not always mad at him, is it like hugely important. But what's interesting is that none of that comes from the script. It entirely comes from the ways in which she acts the lines she's given. Because if you just went off of the dialogue that she has, you'd think this person just despises this guy and has you know, no reason to be around him. And then there's a weird moment at the end of this movie where then you would suddenly feel lost. Like, why does this happen? But if you pay attention to the way that Leslie Mann plays that character from moment one, there is actually like plenty of moments where you watch her smile at things that Sonny says, like take a joke he says harmlessly and bounce it right back at him. Like there is a level, and this is supposed to be the quote unquote bitch best friend, right? Like the character he just should not get along with. But clearly they have a developed dynamic that is much more interesting than that, right? And now, like, that being said, it is bluntly that trope. Like, I don't want to act like this movie like redefined any of this shit, but I'm just pointing out that there is a nuance there, and I think it is entirely on the shoulders of Leslie Mann, and I just want to congratulate that, because it's awesome that a character like that can have that level of any level of nuance.
It's written, she is definitely written as that, and it is elevated by the performance. Her body language, like just subtle motions that she does. That scene, and we talk about there are added scenes because they got extra money. The scene where she's cleaning up the party the next day, that is huge character development to the eventual like resolution of the entire piece. But she is supposed to be this bitch best friend that he doesn't get along with. And I think when we explore that a little bit deeper, once we get past the synopsis of the film, there's some interesting stuff that lies there.
Yeah.
We'll have to muck through, as it were.
We talked about Layla, right? Joey Lauren Adams, Layla, and how kind of interesting of a character she actually is. That she's not just there just to be the prize at the end of the rainbow. Then there's Corinne, there's Leslie Mann. And then, like, you'd be remiss to not also point out Vanessa, who is supposed to be kind of the for what this movie has as far as antagonists go, she's really the only true like verbal one. And even then, again, this movie does complete justice to her in that she is completely justified in everything that she does to Sonny. So the antagonistic nature that she kind of portrays in this film is entirely earned by Sonny. Sonny is not supposed to be somebody that you feel bad for, specifically in the moments in which Vanessa's like, I'm leaving you, you're a man child. Like, yeah, no, he is. Like the way in which he reacts to finding Sid in her bathroom, and like then he's like, oh, it's okay, you're old, you can't possibly be a threat against me. And then, like, you know, and then that bounce back. Like, there is so much laid on there for this Vanessa character, who I think is really only just those two scenes, right? Like,
she has three scenes in the film. She has the opening, she has the Sid reveal, and then she has the comeuppance at the end at Hooters.
Yeah. So there's even that element to it as well is really developed and interesting, despite it also being extremely tropey. So like, this movie does a very good job of elevating just a lot of the stuff that he's already been doing.
Exactly. All right. And then the big fact figure for me is that this is the most profitable live action Adam Sandler film.
Yeah,
and I think that was the thing that holds profitable.
Yeah, it was the most profitable Adam Sandler film until you got to Hotel Transylvania, right?
The sequel.
That's right. It wasn't the first one.
One that elevated over the earnings that Big Daddy had, and so it's still number two, right? So it is. So if we are Hollywood, right? If we take off the Devin and Sijin masks and we reveal that I'm Holly and you're Wood, we would be salivating over this film, and we would want thousands of Big Daddies forever and ever into perpetuity. And we kind of get that. And that's also something that we can explore a little bit later into this thing. But if we don't say the synopsis at this point, Sijin, I think we're going to miss our window.
I just want to the last thing that we should talk about in terms of facts and figures, right, is that I was not kidding when I said this was kind of the family favorite film, because like when you also look at the ways in which this movie is he wins a Teen Choice Award, he wins the People's Choice Award, it wins the Kids Choice Award. Like, this is the movie where like a lot where the age range slowly starts to expand, and it has to because he's getting older, so he doesn't want to leave the audience behind that he's garnered, but he also wants to keep making new fans, right? And the wider the audience you're aiming for, the cleaner and kind of more shallow comedy might have to get, right? And it kind of leads to a lot of later, like, this is, we'd be remiss to ignore the fact that this is kind of one of the first times where he really hits it big in a lot of different age categories, and then, as you said, makes a bunch of money doing it, while at the same time critics are just panning the shit out of this movie. He also wins a bunch of Razzies for this one, right? Yeah. Like or at least he won a Razzie and everybody else was like nominated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like the movie is just like just shat on, but he also wins a bunch of popular choice awards, and then on top of that makes a fuck ton of money, and he starts kind of learning some really bad lessons starting with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, this is the movie that everybody says when Adam Sandler films started to get all sentimental, and that's not what I want in my comedy, especially something with Adam Sandler. Those are real things I read in reviews on IMDb, and then Amazing. They're like, but I give it 7 out of 10. You know, I like it, but there are those people who are like, "Duh, why all sentimental?" Adam.
Well, we'll talk about the sentimentality when we get to some facts and figures. Yeah. I mean, some blues and
new
borrows,
old borrowed
later.
And blues.
Yeah, but hit me up first with that synopsis.
All right, Sonny Koufax is a man content. A fortuitous cab running over his foot awarded him with $200,000 in damages, which he wisely invested in a little company that could. Microsoft, securing himself a comfortable existence. It's no wonder that he has no drive or desire to pursue the legal profession he went to school for. Unfortunately for Sonny, despite finding his bliss, the rest of his friends are beginning to outgrow him. His buddies from law school are all busy with high-profile cases, his roommate Kevin is traveling to China for his job, and is newly engaged to former Hooters waitress and current podiatrist, Corinne. Worst of all, his girlfriend since college, Vanessa, is tired of his lack of drive, and has decided to reevaluate if she wants to spend the rest of her life with a person so happy to be doing nothing with his. Sonny's entire universe is thrown into upheaval when a 5-year-old boy named Julian is left at his doorstep on the day Kevin is leaving for China. Julian is Kevin's biological son, and his mother is dying of cancer, leaving him as the best choice to raise their child. Should Kevin prove unable, Julian's mother has arranged for a foster family to take her son. The only flaw in this plan is that the social services office is closed on Columbus Day, which means that for the next 24 hours, Sonny is going to be responsible for someone other than himself. After having a blast playing father to Julian for the day, Sonny decides that he is going to adopt him, not even considering the bonus of Vanessa seeing him as trying to take on more responsibility and actually doing something with his life. However, it is Vanessa who has a surprise for Sonny when she introduces him to her new boyfriend Sid when he visits to show off their new son. This brings Sonny back to Earth, and he decides to turn Julian over to social services and the foster family. But when he learns that Julian will be placed in an orphanage, he decides to step up and take responsibility for him, knowing that it will be difficult. Though having Julian in his life forces Sonny to fast-track his personal maturation, that doesn't matter when social services discover he committed fraud by pretending to be Julian's biological father. Luckily, when all the chips are down and Sonny is facing legal consequences and Julian a life in the foster system, Kevin returns from China to declare he won't be pressing charges against Sonny for his illegal actions and agrees to take custody of his son. Fast forward 1 year, 3 months, and 6 days, and Sonny's brief 6 weeks with Julian have inspired him to finally become a lawyer, get married to Corinne's sister Layla, and have a son of his own. As a bonus, he still gets to have Julian as a part of his life, thanks to his friendship with Kevin.
Yeah, man. The one plot point that we should probably parse out just a little bit more, is just so that people truly understand what happens in this movie, is there is one scene in this movie that completely turns Sonny on a dime. And it works. Like, when you're watching it, you don't really, it doesn't feel unearned. In retrospect, it's funny that it is just this one moment. But it is when he goes and he talks to Julian's teacher, right?
Yeah.
At some point, he says to Julian, like, what do you want to do? And Julian says, I want to go to school. And it's a weirdly kind of poignant, like, thing that he says there, right? Where he's just like, see, I haven't pushed him and he's made the right decision. We'll enroll you on Monday is essentially the end of that scene, right? Mm-hmm. And sure enough, they go. And it's after a couple of days at school, or is it on the first day? It seems pretty time in the
time
movie is
has
a little...
passed. Time has started. The fact that it's 6 weeks is sort of a big deal.
Yeah.
It's certainly time has passed because he has his second date with Layla, and then they go to dinner together, and he's like, it's been a while since we tried to set something up. So they try to tell you Julian has been going to school for some time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when he goes so, and...
yeah, and there's yeah. the parent-teacher
conference. And then it's, Sonny then it's has parent-teacher day, so...
Yeah, and he talks to Julian's teacher, and she just lays the law down on him. She's like, look, this kid is misbehaving in these ways. He's got some real outburst problems. In addition to that, he's not performing well when it comes to the actual academics. And it actually means something to Sonny. And I think part of this is just the kind of this is a very Sandler-esque thing in which he very much respects educators, which is clear even in something like Billy Madison, right? Like, did we ever find out, is his mom like a teacher or something? Like, there's like a level of respect for like educators that he always seems to give. The only time that we don't see it is in Waterboy. He gives respect to the idea that he needs an education. He wants to learn, but it is one particular educator that's an asshole to him that he doesn't like, right? But other than that, like, the idea of him going to college to better himself is like the plot of that movie. Like, right? So like, so there's this weird respect of education that Sandler seems to have, and it finds itself in this movie in that when this woman comes to him and says all this stuff, it'd be very easy to see this character completely like blowing his shit up, swearing at this woman, pulling his kid out of school, and then like homeschooling him or some nonsense like that, and hilarity would ensue. But instead, complete and utter acceptance that he has fucked up and needs to change his entire life around in order to turn this kid's entire life around. It just is an instant.
And I want to lay all of the credit on that at the feet of Mrs. Foote. I hate myself, because she understands the best way to approach the problem with Sonny, which is the fact that your son is the smelly kid. Like, she understands that this guy, looking at his clothes and everything, what will cut through everything, what will avoid the outburst, what will avoid it, is if she puts it in terms that he will understand. Yeah. And the fact that he is raising the smelly kid in class, that means all the world to him. And he needs to do everything within his power to make sure that Julian is no longer the smelly kid.
Yeah. And what really kind of strikes you in that moment is like Sonny is throughout this entire film extremely reactionary. And on a larger scale, Sandler characters up to this point especially, like, the comedy comes from them being reactionary characters, saying things they don't necessarily mean, but they know in the moment will hurt the most. And that sort of shit is every character up to this point, if you really look at it, that's always where they start. And the idea is that they grow out of that in some way. Like, they lose that as they mature throughout the films, right? Individually, yeah, in each of their own films, I mean. But so there is that element to it where he is very reactionary at first, and then he realizes that he's, you know, setting a bad example for this kid, so he doesn't want to do that anymore. So he matures in order to help this kid grow up. Like, is great on paper. The problem that I'm going to point out, the first time I'm going to throw some criticism at this movie, is it is like a plateau of him just being an asshole, and then this one moment in the scene happens, and then it's all up from there, which is great. But that also comes like what, an hour into the movie? Like, so like up until this point, it is very much like, oh, this guy shouldn't have a baby, which is the joke. But holy crap, does this movie really show you how much he should not have a kid?
I mean, I have a real problem with this movie, and I think this is the time to address it. And that is the fact that everybody acts like Sonny is a fucking loser, and I don't see it. The film doesn't ever indicate to me that Sonny is actually this loser character.
It feels very self-fulfilling. People treat him like a loser, and so what he does is he behaves like one, which leads people to treat him like one. And so he's gotten into a bad cycle where people don't give him the credit that they should, and because of that, he never tries for it, and the more he slacks off, the more people see him as a slacker. But I think this movie is trying to say, to this point specifically, I think this movie is trying to say that a lot of that comes from his relationship with his dad, which is quote-unquote repaired by the end of this movie. Again, another moment that I don't know if it fully earned because of how fast it comes. But that idea being that, I think that we are supposed to believe that since the overarching plot of this film and the concept of this film is the ways in which dads raise sons, that he is the way he is because of his relationship with his dad, and it is because his dad never gave him like the credit that he is due. He is just portrayed loser the whole time. So I don't think you're wrong. I think you're actually very right in the ways that people don't give him credit when they really should for some of the stuff that he does. But a lot of what they are giving him shit about, and the reason that they don't want to give him that credit, is because he pisses them off to the point where they don't want to give it to him, and he's doing that on purpose in a lot of those moments.
Yeah, because if he gets credit for doing good, then it acknowledge it, and he needs to continue doing it. It's a weird thing. I don't
Yeah,
know.
it's
It's
really
just
weird. No,
it's.
people do not give him enough credit. I mean, like you mentioned that I first of all, I missed the whole Microsoft part of the whole thing. I just thought he was still working off of the 200,000 he got from the cab thing. But that alone is kind of a big deal because you know the reason he got that much money is because he's a good lawyer,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. The fact that he and we see that he's a good lawyer because Phil comes to him saying, "I'm working like 16-hour shifts trying to figure out this thing, and it looks like all the work we've done is going to be thrown out." And he's like, "Oh, why not the Foreign Corrupt Policy Act?" And he's like, "Oh my God, that's genius." And it's the guy who works one day a week at a toll booth who's able to come up with that idea, and probably because he's not so close to it, but he still has the legal training. Like, it's not like he washed out of law school. He got his degree from law school. He's just never taken the bar exam.
Yeah, and he gave up and walked away from it because he felt he was not adequate for it because of the ways in which people treat him. It's a, like I said, it's a self-fulfilling cycle that Sonny has found himself in. And yeah, the way people treat him in this movie is shit, but he also kind of invites that in himself. And we don't know enough about Sonny's life to truly know where that started. We don't know if he started off just not getting enough love from his dad, and so he just became this, or if at some point there's something happened to him and this is kind of what he learned he could get away with, and he's a much more terrible person than we're giving him credit for. We don't know that. I think the movie wants us to just kind of jump on the bandwagon of his dad broke him, and he's never been able to repair himself until he had a kid of his own. It's supposed to be the character arc we're supposed to ride.
Right. And I just don't see it. I don't see it because I mean, the thing that I remember, right? Memory that I had is the fact he's just living off of a settlement from the cab accident, from the cab running over his foot. Watching this film the first time that I did it as a 35-year-old man and being like, no, he says to his dad, "No, I mean, I know I have that money, but I invested in the stock market and it's doing good, so I don't really need to worry about money right now." Like, that's one of the first lines he says to his father is, "You don't need to worry about me. I'm not calling for money or anything like that. I'm settled. I have a pretty comfortable life because I've been smart with that $200,000."
Yeah.
And then
I wonder if that's kind of the same thing that we hear Seinfeld kind of talk about sometimes in a lot of his comedy and in the show and stuff, where he kind of tries to he doesn't want to let his parents know how well off he is, not because he thinks they're going to take advantage of it, but rather that like they just they're weird about money, right? And like, and that is something that Seinfeld addresses specifically, right? And I wonder if it's supposed to be that same idea where like he's not letting his dad know how much money he has because he doesn't want him to be like, you know, first of all, on his case about choosing to live the life he does with as much money as he probably does, considering everything that he pays for in this movie. But like, there's this weird element to it where it's kind of like a caring, loving thing that he doesn't want his parents to worry about money, but he also doesn't want to throw it in their face that like, hey, I've got this much, you know, it's a weird dynamic for sure, and this movie does not take any time to try and earn it. Just like it doesn't with any of its big moments. That's what I mean. Is a lot of things happen in this movie because they're supposed to, and I don't know if this movie always earns it. Now, I may be giving a little bit away of my borrowed here, but I wonder if that's because on some level, this movie is trying to satire a concept that is already in cinema, and it.
All right. Why don't we cut right through into the new old borrowed blue? I know where I am with my thoughts on this, and I do need to parse them out. The last thing I have to say before we start the segment, though, is that Microsoft moment, the moment where I found out it was Microsoft, is when they're denting the cans in the store. Because what he says to Julian is, "Microsoft is down 3 points." So that means that not only are his investments in the stock market apparently enough to support this lifestyle that we see him live this entire movie, he got in at a time where Microsoft was cheap and like is probably rolling in it. Like, that's like, but also the way that he lives his life and all that, he's frugal because I feel like that's just how he was taught to live. So like, and it also feels as if it is this image that he's trying to portray to the world so that they don't start getting on his case about things. There's the moment where Corinne calls him dirty and poor, and I'm like, maybe he's dirty. I believe he's hygienic. I think he showers maybe every other day, maybe not every day, but he doesn't really keep a clean house, as evidenced by all of the newspaper all around. But to call him poor just seems grossly incorrect.
Well,
based on everything we see in the movie,
the prime example of this exact issue that you're talking about is the relationship between him and Corinne. Corinne has all of these issues with Sonny and the ways that he behaves, but at no point does she ever give him credit. But I will point out the climax of this movie, when finally she is put on the stand to be a character witness specifically put on the stand for her feelings against him for him. It's an interesting moment for the character, maybe not in actual legal precedent, and we'll get to that later, but this idea being that, like, she's put on the stands as a character witness specifically because of her feelings about him, and even she has to come clean about how much she likes him and how much she would trust him, right? And that reveal kind of takes everything that you've seen up to that point and puts it in a brand new light, right?
Yeah, I gotcha. I don't know. It's just it seemed wildly incongruous.
The movie does not earn everything that it wants you to believe about this world or this film. You're completely right about that.
Okay. All right. So now every episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we do a fun little segment, and it was supposed to come earlier, but increasingly it's happening around the hour mark, called Something New, Something Old, Something Borrowed, Something Blue, where we talk about something new to the Adam Sandler Shared Cinematic Universe, if this movie were to be part of it, something old from the existing movies that we've covered, something borrowed from the entire pantheon of cinematic history, and something blue, the definition of which is always hotly contended. So for new, I'd like to go first, because I'm going to let you go first for old, because I have an entire Uno deck full of olds that I can pull out.
Yeah.
So I'll take the new. And you know what? Maybe I'm an asshole here. Maybe I'm overstepping. But New York, not specifically as a character, but the establishing shots that show the Twin Towers, this is the first time that we're getting something like that in the five movies that we've seen Adam Sandler do chronologically, right? Even though they do go to New York briefly in The Wedding Singer, it's at night and there are no real skyline shots. This is the first, like, set in New York Adam Sandler film. It's not the first one that we've covered, because Little Nicky is also very much set in New York, but the way that the world is manipulated and focusing on, like, more underground stuff, you don't really have those big skyline shots.
Yeah.
In this movie, New York is sort of a character, and it's the first time that we've truly seen that in one of these Adam Sandler films that we've covered.
Yeah, well, I mean, it feels like he's on the streets of New York when he's on the streets of New York, right? Like, that is the on-set nature of this film is very different than the wild kind of backlot sets that they were on for things like Billy Madison, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah.
It's .
Yeah, I mean, like, well, and it's interesting because of how important we know that scene really is to him, right?
Yes.
Even at the time, knowing him coming off of SNL, like New York is an important city to him, and later in his career, he celebrates that a thousand times over.
He really, really does celebrate it later. I mean, I think it's interesting to see him play a character who is staunchly a Bruins fan in something like Happy Gilmore, to somebody who is rooting actively for the Rangers, which just seems like that would be very difficult for me to do.
I think what that is that he is a hockey fan.
Yeah,
like, that's the big
fan.
Thing.
Yeah.
He's the kind of guy that, like, he'd be playing fantasy hockey now. It wouldn't be about teams. It'd be about his team, right? Like, that's really the kind of guy Sonny really is when it comes to that.
You say that, but then I also think about, like, Ben Affleck in Gone Girl, where he refused to wear the Yankees hat. And I don't see Adam Sandler ever doing something like that.
No, I think maybe in the real world. I think he's just a hockey guy, right?
Yeah. But he's definitely a hockey guy. Yeah. That's one of the reasons why I like him.
Yeah, awesome. So for me, the new is, I mean, I'll steal a phrase you already said earlier. I was going to say a sentiment, but that would give it away. Sentimental sandaler, right? Not necessarily the first time we've seen it here at the show, but the first time that in his kind of repertoire that he has pulled it out in one of his bigger movies. And like to the point where we literally see tears at some point in his eyes in this movie, right? Like he allows himself on screen to push himself as far as sentimentality goes in a way that he has not done yet. Even with The Wedding Singer under his belt at this point, because a lot of what he does in The Wedding Singer is a lot of humor to get through the pain style, like sentimentality, right? Whereas in this one, there are legitimate moments where he is alone in a room and feels a thing, and like, and it's wild. You know, some of the best scenes in this movie are the ones when he finally has some confidence. The one specifically that I'll point out is when he runs into Layla's office, right? And him and Joey Lauren Adams are like talking about, like, you need to come to my, you know, you need to be there in court that day. And she's like, I have a life outside of you and this kid, and I didn't, this is exactly why I knew I shouldn't get involved. And it's a moment where he does not get angry with her. He's just upset about what's going on around him. He realizes how much he has made mistakes up to this point, and it's really fucked him. Like, there's so much going on in his character in that moment, and it is some of the most genuine acting that we've seen from him up to this point in any of these films. And it hits, right? And so, like, I can appreciate the idea that people saw that there was something new going on in his acting in this movie. I don't agree with them disliking it because of that, saying this isn't why I come to Adam Sandler movies. Like, fuck that. The guy has earned the right to like flex a little bit on screen for you, all right? Like I don't need my favorite actor to play the exact same character in every movie I see them in. I want to see them try and stretch their wings. And in getting to see him in this, I think really it was cool.
Along that same line, though, talking about a sentimental Sandler and this sort of being the first time we see him, like reeling it, the reason why it sticks out and the reason why I think you would categorize it as a new, and this is my opinion on it, is that it's almost unchecked and an overload of sentimentality.
Yep.
You mentioning the fact that the entire final act of this movie is essentially one long sentimental, like emotional, like just globule that you are
Let me
thrown into.
throw the word saccharine out there. This movie is saccharine. And like to a point where it is sickening. Yes, for sure.
But because I'm a person, and I don't know if I've ever cried on this show, but I've definitely cried on the Say Report talking about things, who reacts to movies, right? I have visceral emotional reactions to things, and that overload of like sentimentality that happens at the end of the movie, my body like just rejected it. I could feel like tears welling up in the sides of my eyes, and then as it just kept continuing, it's like, no, we're not being tricked by this. This is manipulation. This is not genuine emotion.
Oh, it's full manipulation, but I'm always somebody that's willing to go along with that. And even I have some tough moments in this movie where I'm like, this is too much. For sure. I will pocket that conversation for a moment until we get to our borrowed section.
I look forward to it because I also think that looking at other films that we have covered, something like Chuck and Larry, that might be why we just experience the emotional whiplash that I referenced so frequently in that episode, because he like learned from this movie that if we're going to be sentimental, we also need to have a joke there.
Yeah, we need
and
to
it's
break that up a little bit.
yeah and that movie feels like the testing ground for it, and that is why I walked away in a neck brace.
But it's what makes his work later on stuff with like Noah Baumbach and stuff so much more impressive, is because he's already exploring this stuff on his own. He just needs to get with somebody that has a little bit more skill than he does at actually, you know,
Parsing
expressing
it out and
nuance.
making it
Yeah.
not just
And
an
that goes as
entire
well for
pool.
actors, like, you know, being on screen with the likes of like Dennis Hoffman and stuff like that later on, like really kind of really it really helps him kind of learn a thing or two about how to actually do this and not make it feel the way that it does in Big Daddy, for sure.
Excellent. All right, so what do you got for old?
So my old I'm gonna throw Josh Mostel out there. As you pointed out, there is like a fucking like deck of cards you could, but I mean, it has been so long since we've seen him, and I was so happy to see him back. And we never see him again. I don't think he ever works in
No,
Sandler
this
again
is
after this.
it, and
So
he.
I'm gonna take the opportunity now to celebrate him.
So fucking happy to see Josh Mostel No idea. I love him as the principal, aka the revolting blob in Billy Madison, and the fact that he brings him back to kind of play that same administrative role in this and a weird sort of antagonist role.
And well, and gives him like a, well, so again, as much as he's antagonistic in what he has to do, at no point is he unjustified in everything that he does.
Exactly.
In this movie,
it's,
right.
Right.
But I love the weird choice, and I don't know if this was him or the script or what, but the like weird kind of Jerry Garcia-esque nature to a lot of his like just oeuvre, where he's just like, let's chill out, man. Like we, none of us get a better high than we can when we can leave a kid with their actual parents. Like it's like, okay, man, what is this choice? I love it because he fucking sticks with it the entire time.
The best line from him, the best line from him, and this again, this is just from me, is when he shows up at the office to be like, I really thought that things were going to be different with this kid. I had a mom ready, and now that it's just me, I'm kind of freaking out. When he shows up and he's like, I didn't ask you to come down here, right? I was just going to send the paperwork out to you. And it's just like, this guy, is this guy present? Is there a message behind this guy about how just like lackadaisical social services is treating children?
Yeah. Well, and so there's, and so it's a weird dichotomy in one character, right? This idea that he clearly has a very big, like a very good understanding of the system, how it works, and its faults. Like he's the first person to admit to Sonny that like, we don't want to put him in a home. We know that that's not how this works, but what other like options am I currently in this chair looking at? Right. Is kind of his whole point. And like, and the ways in which he has to, he's like, the one that hits me really the hardest is when Sonny kind of calls him out when he comes to collect Julian at the end of the movie. And he says like, or I'll have you arrested, or I think he says, I will arrest you. And Sonny calls him out on the line. He's like, oh yeah, what, where are your handcuffs? And he says, I don't have any, but the cops downstairs do. Like, man, like, don't make me do this in front of the kid.
I don't want to arrest you.
Like, right.
This
it's
is
like
not...
it hit that line where he explains exactly what the situation is, like, hits real hard. And you have to imagine that Sandler must have grown up on Zero Mostel, right? And so like getting to work with Josh Mostel even once on Billy Madison. And then having him coming back for something like this, like it just, there's a lot of really good moments between just the two of them in this movie. A couple of really good moments between the two of them in this movie. You're right. He serves to kind of be the face for this antagonistic kind of overarching feeling that the government is eventually going to step in, which I mean, like what a weird thing. Like in this movie where this guy kidnaps this kid, we're actually like, no, don't let the police show up. But like, but there's this whole idea that he has to carry that weird weight, and he does it. He does it beautifully. So I just wanted to give a shout out because we're probably not going to address him again as an actor in
this
film.
I think this is the last opportunity to address him based on everything that I remember, which seems like a pretty solid segue into my old, which is Leslie Mann, because I feel like a fucking idiot. This movie made me feel like a fucking idiot because when we covered Funny People last April, or this past April, right? I don't know, the April 2022, I'm like, I don't know if they've ever worked together before. Completely forgetting that she was in Big Daddy, which is really all the indication that you need that I just kind of didn't remember this movie any deeper than a few like standout pinnacle moments.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I didn't even call it out either when we watched it, but it really kind of nails home a lot of what we said in that movie, in that episode, about the relationship between him and Apatow and that crowd at that time. And this is just early evidence of it, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. But I do need to say, like, us seeing Leslie Mann again, and I mean, one of the reasons why we ended up not putting spoilers for Funny People into the universe was because we don't have anyone really coming back. Leslie Mann is somebody who comes back, and I just was unaware of that. So I do want to, you know, kind of mea culpa, come forward and say I'm sorry for not having a completely encyclopedic knowledge of all of the films that Adam Sandler has done, even the ones that I might have seen.
Again, but, Devin, we're archaeologists. We don't know it all until we dig it up. That's
exactly
why we're here.
Exactly.
We are always learning and always changing.
Right. Which is one of the reasons why I want to come and say that.
I want to bounce that back to you really quick. I'm not changing my opinion on Funny People not being in the universe. There are other reasons.
Leslie
Mann suddenly showing up does not change my opinion on that particular aspect of that episode.
I completely agree, and I'm glad that we're just covering right now, so we don't need to talk about it in the
we don't need to
in
do
the
a
decision moment.
Like that.
No. It is Funny People definitely does not fit into the universe as we have been constructing it based upon the ruins, relics, and remnants that we have found in the Adam Sandler cinematic
universe. I think we kind of came to terms with the fact that Funny People is basically like the watcher of this universe.
Yeah, and it sort of supports that, even in terms of the fact that while Leslie Mann is in both of these movies, the character she plays and what she brings to each of the films is so wildly different. Like, if it were Leslie Mann that he dated in this movie, then it's a different conversation. But yeah, her sort of being an antagonist instead of a love interest, completely different stuff. And it really does talk to everything that we said in Funny People. Go listen to our Funny People episode. That's what this is. This is self
advertisement. And to Leslie Mann in this movie, because I want to keep giving credit to her because of just how much she actually does pull in this film and in life. I just love Leslie Mann. But I don't think that there's a thing that she says or says about Sonny that she probably doesn't also in some way think about Adam Sandler. There's a lot between the two of them that feels so natural. You have to assume that a lot of what's going in between their specific relationship, right? Like, you could very easily see her and him in real life having that kind of antagonistic friendship that some people just develop sometimes. And maybe not to the extent it's in this movie, but they definitely give each other shit in real life because they're clearly ripping on a couple of lines in this movie. That specific one that you pointed out earlier where she goes, well, because he's dirty and poor. The "and poor" feels like it was such a just thrown in there moment just for her to just drive home what an asshole he is. But you're right that it doesn't actually make sense considering what we know about him in this movie. And I think the reason it doesn't make sense is it was probably just improv. It was probably just Leslie Mann just giving shit to Adam Sandler.
Yeah, and it's also the way that she views him against literally her fiance, who is, you know, he's in China right now working in foreign currency while he's at home eating cereal and hanging out with a 5-year-old. Because to her, he just identifies Julian as his friend for so long with her. And what it actually, and I think there's another reason for that semi-antagonistic relationship between Sonny and the Corinne character. While we're talking about Leslie Mann, seems like a perfect thing. He is afraid, and there's actually a conversation that supports this, that she is going to take away his best friend. Yeah. And she is afraid that if she commits her life to Kevin, she's always going to have to deal with his best friend.
Yep.
They hate each other because each of them represent a prophecy that they do not want their life to continue. He doesn't want to have a life without Kevin. She doesn't want to have a life with Kevin. That also means basically having Sonny as a tag along.
Yeah, again, their relationship is very antagonistic. It literally is mutually assured destruction, right? Yeah. Like, if either of them fucks up the relationship with the other, they are also fucking up the relationship they themselves have with Kevin. And so, like, it is this weird kind of balance that they have to be in. And what's great about both of these characters is they don't shy away from each other because of that relationship. They don't try and stay away from each other. There's no like, no, she can't come over, I hate her. There's none of that. I mean, as you mentioned, like, he wakes up and she's still there. He, like, Kevin's not, but she is there cleaning the apartment and stuff, right? It's a really good relationship, but that's really interesting to watch in this movie from 1999, where you didn't have a lot of really interesting platonic male female relationships.
It shines. It shines. And that's probably why we've dedicated so much of this episode to talking about it. But also, we wasted the good surprise on you.
Yeah. And it just keeps coming back, even in the last moment of the movie. Oh, was this another wasted surprise?
Hope you didn't waste the
me?
Good surprise on me.
Yeah. Oh,
it's,
man.
It's some good stuff. And I think it's fitting that at the end of it, they're in-laws. I just think that really works.
I love that. It's beautiful.
I'll also let you go borrowed because I feel like you're chomping at the bit to share your borrowed. So and if your borrowed is my borrowed, I'm going to slap you. I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to fly to Utah and I'm going to slap you across the face.
It's Chris Columbus.
Ah!
It is
the explorer.
No, I'm kidding.
The director.
It's the director. It is Chris Columbus. This movie, I couldn't quite put my finger on why I'd been feeling like this movie had like weird ripples in it, like almost like I had seen a prequel or a sequel to this movie. So it's not this exact movie, but I had seen stories related to it. And then I realized what it was it's the 35th anniversary this year of Adventures in Babysitting. And so, like, I've rewatched the movie. I, like, read, like, an article, like, a couple of weeks ago about it. Like, it's been, like, a weird kind of presence in my life. And this movie, the ways in which it kind of apes on that, and then the more that I dug into Chris Columbus, because in the specific interview I read, they were talking to Elizabeth Shue, and she said, well, you know, Chris loves these kinds of movies. He loves working with kids, and he loves working with adults with kids and having this kind of fun. It's what made working on this movie great, and it's what worked for him and so many others. And sure enough, you look back over all of the movies that he had made, especially up to this point, you have things like Mrs. Doubtfire is on that list. You have Adventures in Babysitting. You have – what was the other
is
big
Uncle
one that
Buck
I found?
One? No, Uncle Buck is John Hughes.
Home Alone. He
yeah,
has the Home Alone.
He has Home Alone, yeah. That's
yeah,
why
that's,
I got
that's
confused
the
there. Yeah.
Yeah, and so like there is he's got this history of working with kids and adults, making these family kind of adventure-y style films where like the kids are maybe doing some stuff that is a little risque and the parents are having to kind of come down to the kids level with a bunch of dick and fart jokes, but it's working in a way that like, I mean, Home Alone can't be denied, right? Is it Home Alone 2 that holds like that huge record for like amount of money at the time and things like that?
Yeah.
Where like the critic goes on to talk about how it must've been a deal with the devil, right?
Well, Dogma, right? Dogma
right,
even talks
right,
about
right,
that.
Right.
Someone
yeah.
had to sell their soul to the devil. I'm so sorry I did a Selma Hayek voice there. It's just, you know. Has she ever been in an Adam Sandler movie?
Yes.
Yes, she has, and we haven't covered him yet. We're going to stop right there. I'm so excited.
She's phenomenal in those movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the so he is definitely seen a Chris Columbus movie or two at this point, right? And there's so much in this movie that is so influenced by that. In like the biggest part of that is kind of the saccharine nature of it. And Chris Columbus isn't the only one making these kinds of films. Other people then kind of hop on board and start doing these kind of family films, and they just get filled with more and more over the top crap to the point where they become more about these emotional beats than they are about the actual story and stuff. And so in some weird way, it feels like a lot of what's going on in this movie is them kind of taking that thing that they do, that Sandler specifically and his crew do, taking a thing that they love that are in movies that they're seeing at the time, have been seeing for years, putting it on display and kind of working with it in their Sandler way. And in some ways you could see that as satire, in other ways you could see that as celebration. But leaning into the oversweetness, the nonsensical moments in nature of like suddenly this character just completely changes because an old woman tells him that he has to treat his kid better, and he's just like, oh shit, I need to grow up. Like you talk about Uncle Buck, and no, I don't know if Chris Columbus was ever involved in that movie, but that's another good example of this exact kind of genre, right? It's just, it's that whole kind of, we've lost, I think, this sense of the family comedy, family adventure that can kind of get a little bit more risque, because when we think of like that style of family film nowadays, they are dumbed down, they are saccharine, they are nonsensical, the stories are very thin, they're 80 minutes long, there's not, you know, like I think of like Alexander and the No Good, Very Horrible Day, like movie that they made a few years ago, or the Diary of Wimpy Kids movies that they've tried to make that try to fall into that same vein, but they don't quite get there for the adults. And then you have like the ones where like the kids don't really kind of get it, what's going on with like the Vacation movies and stuff like that. When I was a kid, we watched Vacation and Christmas Vacation with my parents all the friggin' time. As far as the new Vacation movie comes out, I don't know if I'd sit my kids down to watch it with me. Part of that is because of the nature of how good those movies are, but part of it is also because there's some shit that goes on in that movie that, like, my kids aren't even going to care about the joke. Never mind get the joke or be offended by the joke. My kids just won't understand it.
Maybe veering a little off the topic, but that new Vacation movie, as a family, the Deckers have watched three different times.
Yeah, well, and
you're
all
I cannot
adults,
believe.
Right?
I know that we're all adults, yeah. But it's just one of those situations where, like, when I saw that in theaters, I'm like, I don't know if I'm ever going to watch that movie again. And then it was coming to HBO, and my father's like, we have to. We have
that
to watch it.
That movie's parts are better than their songs.
Definitely.
Individual
oh
scenes of that
God.
Movie are
yeah.
pretty fucking funny. The all of the Reno guys doing the Four Corners.
The Four
Sheriff.
Corners thing is fantastic.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
The stuff with the guy who ends up playing Chael in Kevin Can Wait, to tie this into Adam Sandler movies, properties, and people. Being the guy who's like, you got a possum on your head
yeah.
when they're in the hot springs.
Right. So like that we've kind of lost our knack for these movies, right?
Yeah.
Even Chris Columbus at this point kind of tries to dip back into this well from time to time, and it doesn't quite work in the same way. It's why he walked away from the Harry Potter movies. He pulled it off with the first one and then kind of was like, I don't know if I could pull that magic twice, like, and then ran out the room, right? But that is, I think, something that is hugely being borrowed on in this movie, is that genre of the saccharine family adventure comedy that we loved at the time and couldn't get enough of, but was getting so bloated by the time this comes around. And I don't think this movie does a good enough job establishing whether or not it's part of the problem or poking at the problem. That is one of the biggest issues that I think this movie has.
To live in this world briefly. First of all, I want to give you all the credit in the world for actually being able to find movies pre-Big Daddy that were Big Daddy-esque, right? And it not being The Kid by Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
So, like, all credit to you for being able to do that. Because trying to think of movies that are like that, also Dutch is something that comes to mind, and I don't want to forget about Dutch. Dead. Yeah.
You know, or Ghost Dad even has some weird elements of it.
Let's
in
never
it.
Bring like, up Ghost Dad,
I mean,
again.
Not to actually ring that bell, but like, there are movies that
Movies that did it that I just couldn't think of, and the reason why is all I could think of were movies in the post-Big Daddy universe, and this schism that you're talking about starts with Big Daddy, because in the wake of Big Daddy, they realize, oh, if we have a big audience, then we can possibly make the same money as Big Daddy. They mm-hmm. sort of tied their hands by going with the PG-13 rating, right? Yes. So yeah. Let's do any. So there's an entire school of thought in Hollywood trying to make money off of the success of Big Daddy, who's like, we'll do Big Daddy, but we'll kind of shave off the edges, we'll smooth it out, and we'll make it acceptable for your PG audiences. And then on the other side of that coin is your bad Santas, your bad words, all of these. It's like Big Daddy, but if Big Daddy wasn't tied by the fact that we're trying to stay PG-13.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting thing, because if those two camps had come together to try to recapture the magic that they were able to get with Big Daddy, they would probably have made the money. But well, looking at this movie and taking away two very different lessons of a like guy who acts mature around child, or, you know, funny guy with child.
are we gonna do the Mrs. Doubtfire thing where you're really kind of getting like the feels for the kids the whole time, and you have those really sad moments and you cry and all this stuff? Or do we just want to turn it into just a fucking balls off like laugh fest? That decision is and it's not that Sandler himself, I will point to him himself trying to recreate this magic years later in so many different movies. We've already talked about the Hotel Transylvania movies, but that's kind of there. I mean, we danced around and have not yet name checked the Grown Ups films, but they're there, right? Like he comes back to this time and time again. And I think the closest he possibly gets, just to put a nice cap in this feather, is that when he works with Chris Columbus on Pixels.
Are you going to call it macaroni? Since it's Chris Columbus, that's Yankee Doodle. I fucked up.
Wait, no, it's okay. I said cap and his feathers, so we were just kind of
well, you know what? It also and no bigger name check of everything you're talking about than the fact that Julian arrives on Columbus Day.
Yeah,
boom.
But there's, you know, I could point to Bedtime Stories. I could point to a bunch of other stuff. Oh, yeah. But like this,
just
is
go
this
with
is
it
something.
Has moments of it blended. We've seen it a lot of times before, trying to recapture it, but also knowing this was a magical thing and we can only approach it like sparingly.
Yes.
Because maybe we overdid it a bit with Big Daddy.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even Chuck and Larry, the moments with Larry's kids. I'm sorry. Chuck is Adam Sandler. So Kevin's kids.
I still get that confused. And we talked about that movie for 2 hours.
That's a good point. Yeah. All right. So to my borrowed, and you, remember, I already have claim over getting on a plane and slapping, right? That belongs to me. So I just remember that when I tell you what my borrowed is.
Okay.
My borrowed is Problem Child.
Yeah.
All
right.
And I am so sorry to be bringing Problem Child and all of the baggage from it, from the Say Report, over to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Yeah. But I have to go with Problem Child because there is one moment in this film that evoked so many Problem Child memories for me.
Yeah.
And it is right when Sonny decides that he's going to, you know, maybe rein in Julian a little bit. We're going to start bathing every day. We're going to start studying a little bit more after the conversation with Miss Foot, when they go to Barney's. No, not that one. The more expensive Barney's. And they buy matching suits.
Yeah, and they come around the corner in those two matching
two matching white suits. And
I
that
had
is
this exact
so...
thought and did not want to do this. I did. I was trying to. I was like, oh no, you'll be invoking the dark magics then.
And it is so little Ben Healy trying to dress Junior like him from the Problem Child movies. And then going deeper down the rabbit hole, the judge at the end of things is Judge Healy. So then it's a secondary, like, moment of saying Beetlejuice, the problem child of this whole thing.
Yeah.
And then come to find out, unbeknownst to me until watching this movie, that problem child is Dennis Dugan's directorial debut.
Oh,
is Dennis Dugan's first movie.
Yeah.
So this weird feeling that's over this film, that it kind of feels like a weird prequel to Problem Child, but where, you know, Junior's discipline problems are caught at a young enough age to repair them before it goes too far. Because a lot of the relationship between Sonny and Julian is very similar to Little Ben and Junior in the Problem Child movies, in the fact that he treats him more like a friend and a peer rather than a father, which is where Junior's overdeveloped sense of self and desire for respect from adults stems from.
Yeah.
And it's that moment where a teacher who's not a jerk, right? It's not fucking Gilbert Gottfried saying to John Ritter, your son's a problem. It is Miss Foot who is approaching Sonny on his level to say, your kid is the smelly kid. And it's on you to fix that.
Right.
That he realizes, you know, it's fun having a pal, but I have friends. This kid needs a father. And right now, I'm the only person who's willing to do that.
Yeah.
And him stepping up.
Yeah. And Sonny's ability to step up is something that's really important, because I feel like there's a lot of that on display in this movie where he always is willing to step up. The problem is that he usually then allows himself or even, you know, does it himself, gets knocked down, right? And this is the first time in his life that he is not going to let that happen. And, you know, it's because there's a kid's life on the line. We're not given much more than that. But for the length of this movie, for the hour and 27 minutes I was with this movie or whatever it is.
I'm like 33. It's 93 minutes.
That works for me, right? I can live in that sensibility for that long, especially for the funny jokes, you know, but yeah, I just Problem Child is another example of those kinds of movies though, right? Like that fall right into that category. It is definitely par for the course for what I was talking
and
about.
And I thought that it was such a cop out, me just going like, oh, I'll go with Problem Child again.
No, but Problem Child's a good one to bring up though, specifically because of the
Dennis Dugan connection that I'm just like, oh, there's something I just had no idea about.
Well, and there's something about the cynical nature of the Problem Child movies, not to call them truly cynical, but they're more cynical than some of the other ones that I pointed out. You know, like there's a lot more cynicism in that than there is in, say, like a Home Alone. Yeah.
Well, there's also, they are specifically satire as well.
Right, right.
Because it's supposed to be a satirization of the Omen films, right?
Right.
What if Damien were actually just a regular kid and not just the spawn of the devil? Mm-hmm. So it also speaks to the fact that Adam Sandler's trying to do a more satirical film on everything that you've brought up from the Christopher Columbus catalog.
Yeah.
Of his friends who are directors, Dennis Dugan seems the natural choice for that.
Yeah, for sure. When is Dennis the Menace, that really weird one with Walter Matthau that comes out?
93 or 94.
Yeah, so that's, I was that's still in Massachusetts. This as well. So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
1993, yeah.
Yeah. God, the video game for that is not finished. That's a Say Report topic, though. Which brings us to Blue. And I think I got it, Siege, and I think I figured it out. I think I understand.
Okay.
My Blue for Big Daddy is the live nudes nightlight, because he's got some blue in there. And also live nudes.
My money was on either that, or I did have a little bit of cash thrown on the side to possibly be the blue stamps that are on delivery guys' lapels for some reason.
No, the blue stamps that are on delivery guys' lapels are the fact... are you talking about... Oh, his... All right. For me, my favorite part about delivery guy is that both sides of his shirt pocket have ink stains.
Yeah.
And that's just like the most realistic thing ever, especially because most of the time that's covered by the Cozy's apron.
Right.
But it is just there's a lot of blue in this movie that I could have gone with. But live nude sign seemed like the one that hues the most in line with your definition of blue. I think I'm understanding you, Seijin.
I got to say, you got extremely close this time. And so I, you know, there's... Here's where I went. I could have gone the obvious route and talked about, once again, having Rob Schneider playing an ambiguously foreign character in this film and that being weirdly offensive, but I'm not sure to who.
But you instead go with the ambiguously gay duo?
No, I actually, even to that point, think that that's handled extremely well. It's a little over the top in how physical they get for no reason, and that's a weird thing to say because people can kiss if they want to kiss. But it's exactly that, right? Is that you don't want to say that because like that's maybe that's just the way this couple is. Other than that, they are human beings with jobs and lives and different opinions from one another. Just because they're gay does not mean that you agree with each other on everything and like all that sort of shit. No, the like. The drop-in gay characters are definitely—it's definitely a level of tokenism for sure. But at a time where a lot of that sort of shit was not being addressed,
At the
and there is
time of the
a
gay panic, the 90s gay panic in
yeah,
media, having like just fully realized characters
yeah, and then it is
is.
actually quietly addressed in just one moment of the movie. But when they're first introduced and they walk away, and there is the moment between him
John Loughran.
John Laughlin there about like, hey, I can't get used to the fact that we used to be best friends with these guys, and he's like, we still are. Just because they're gay doesn't mean we're not friends with them, and they're the same people, dude. Get over it. Is like that's a moment in this movie. So like, good on them. Like that. No, it's not even that. I am actually going to take this opportunity because we already know how bad the Rob Schneider stuff is. We've waxed poetical about that many an episode. It's just as bad here. The end on that conversation. I don't think it's the gay stuff because I think it's handled really well. I'm actually going to say that it is the homeless character. We have not really talked about this yet at all, but it happens from time to time in these movies. But there are often financially not well off characters in these films that are portrayed to be as like lower class jokes, and it does feel a bit like punching down every time we see them. Like there is a lot of there's a lot to unpack and say about the idea that the homeless guy in this movie, who doesn't even get a name despite the fact that he shows up in many a scene eventually, like is played by Steve Buscemi, is given like dialogue and lines and like backstory, and we learn about him, and he ends up actually having like plot significant like growth that we learn about, like his whole like revelation about how he got the way he is because of his poor relationship with his father, which again this movie is just hammering home how like how it feels about that specific relationship. Like it is still, at the end of the day, just a poor portrayal of a person that is in a shit situation that we are putting into this comedy movie and laughing at in some ways because of the situation that they're in.
Yeah, no, I
You
can.
know, like, so yeah, it's not great.
What I am going to say though, because rewatching this movie the way that I have these past 2 days, right? Like watching it three, four times to make sure I am decided on my opinions about Big Daddy. There's that scene in the park where, he's trying to be better for Julian, where they're holding up the signs warning the rollerbladers that it's like a steep hill, and if they don't slow down, they're probably gonna wipe out and fall into the river. It's like a pond. And that scene to me was always the homeless guy kind of disregarding what they're saying, but watching it again all these multiple times, like he's not upset about the sausage McMuffin. It's just like, hey, you still owe me a sausage McMuffin. And then I believe he does try to slow down, but then he hits the pole.
Yeah, he fails and
Like he
hits the pole.
fails, and like it's not that he wipes out. It is the fact that in slowing down, he doesn't have enough speed to avoid the lamppost that is
Okay,
there.
so you want to know something extremely buck wild about that specific scene? The on Netflix, it is currently streaming on Netflix. The subtitles are not one for one. That happens sometimes. I don't know why. The subtitles for this movie are not one to one. From the moment he hits the pole to the end of that scene, when Julian turns to Sonny and they have like a back and forth, and then the scene ends, no more subtitles. So he gets up. And I clearly see his mouth moving. He clearly has a lot going on that he's saying, whether it's nonsense or not, I don't know. I have no idea what he said in that moment. But it was a whole other level to watching him hit that pole, get up, start just moving his mouth and nothing coming out. And I'm at the moment, I'm like typing up some case notes at work and looking over at the scene because I see that Steve Buscemi is talking out of the corner of my eye, but I'm not seeing the words anymore. So I'm wondering if I'm like missing something. And sure enough, no, he's just talking and nothing is happening on screen. And so it added a whole other level to whatever happens in that moment. Was he just moving his mouth in that moment or does
He
he actually have a line?
babbles. He's
Yeah.
like he's trying to put together words, but he clearly has like a concussion or something.
They don't even do that. They don't even
They don't
imply
even they
that.
don't even like unintelligible speaking or something
Nothing.
like that.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's
nothing.
that's insane, 'cause I don't watch the movies with the subtitles, so I'm glad that you're out there doing the work. That is, I mean, it's a weird scene anyway, the fact that, like, and then he just passes out, and they're like, so we should probably go and, like, not take care of this guy who we kind of have a relationship with.
Yeah. Again, the way in which this character is treated is not grand. It's just another thing that is, it feels very callous. It feels very careless in the ways in which they were like, oh, it'd be funny if there's like a homeless dude that he owes a McMuffin to the whole time, right? Like the newspaper guy from
$2.
All right. So that was what I pulled out kind of as the thing that hit me the wrong way.
I respect that. I guess I kind of had money aside on the slut shaming, the constant shame that he throws at Corinne for having worked at Hooters at one point in her life.
That is a really interesting conversation as well. Yes, there is a lot of really weird stuff about that. What's even weirder to me is Hooters is clearly like invested in this movie.
Yeah, like,
and then Hooters comes back later, right? Because Pixels, I mentioned Pixels, don't they go to a Hooters in the beginning of that movie to like eat wings? Isn't that like
they just go to a random restaurant. Hooters comes back in Blended.
That's where
like he has a huge connection to Hooters because that's where his wife worked before she passed away.
That's what I mean, though, is Hooters eventually comes back on board the whole Adam Sandler train, and the way that this movie, or the way that specifically Sonny treats in this movie. However, the two things to point out about that is, didn't Corinne work at a Hooters, right?
Yeah, that's her. That's the whole thing.
That's the joke.
Is that he always calls her.
Vanessa was working at Hooters, or does she just end up at the Hooters in the end?
So Corinne worked at Hooters. That's where Kevin met her and started dating her. And she was only working there to go through medical school because it is established that she's a podiatrist later on in the film. And then the final moment, they're having dinner. At Sonny's birthday dinner is at a Hooters, and that's where he runs back into Christy Swanson playing Vanessa, and he's like, what about Sid's 5-year plan? And he's a fry cook at Hooters.
Yeah. Well, so is it established? Yeah, there's just some weird, it's just a weird element where Hooters is felt to be like this like weird bottom of the barrel, and it is treated as such throughout. And it's just a wild thing because if it was just the Corinne story, you could point to the fact that while Sonny is an asshole about it, everybody else around her is very supportive of like who she is and what she's become. And the fact that they go there in the end, it could just be like Sonny is just a dick and you could write it off as that.
I mean, knows that it's something that will always kind of get under her skin.
Right.
And that really talks to the relationship. Sorry.
Yeah, but then the movie leans into it by showing you that the punishment for the antagonistic like female character of this movie is that she ends up there as a waitress. It establishes hardcore that it's not just Sonny, that the whole movie does see it that way. And it's just like this weird like, okay, this went from being questionable to just being gross. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I'm just like, this is uncomfortable every time, like him bringing it up. And like even Kevin, like, you need to get off of it. Though Jon Stewart, and we haven't even brought up Jon Stewart yet this deep into the episode, does have that beautiful thing where he's like, can you stop calling her Big Boobs McGee? She graduated from medical school. It's Dr. Big Boobs McGee now.
Jon Stewart is doing that thing that he always does when he does these great bit parts in movies. Watch Half-Baked for another one, like where he seems to just be himself on set.
Oh, that's like, my exact note is good for Jon Stewart and his whole shtick of I'm going to tell a joke and then explain the joke.
But he is charming as a human and he knows it. He is good in small doses and he knows it, right? Like he knows exactly how he works even at this point in his career, right? This early on. We're not even talking about like mid-2000s like hot shit in the Daily Show Jon Stewart. This is even pre that, right? I think he's still working as like a fucking VJ for MTV or something at this point. But he is just phenomenally funny, exactly as charming as he needs to be, and completely believable as this character who has to be a guy that is super successful now, but at one point in his life, 6 years ago, definitely had the ability to make the mistake of sleeping with a woman, then just bouncing the next day and never talking to her again.
About that is that they have the cover of the 94 World Series where he would have, not 94, the 93 World Series where he slept with Jan McGrath.
Yeah.
Framed in their apartment.
Yeah.
It is like this beautiful bit of mise-en-scene foreshadowing that, like, it's an Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah.
It's competent filmmaking and that attention to detail that we celebrate at this show. I love it. It's I do love
So
it.
I want to introduce an idea that about this movie that I like to more to the point of that we were making about how this is really borrowing from kind of a trend that's going on at this time. I think this movie would have been much better received critically, probably just as well audience-wise, since we know it was received really well audience-wise. But I think this movie would have been much more critically. I think this movie gets a bad critical rap because it's an Adam Sandler movie. Imagine if this movie had come out and it was Tom Hanks. Like, this movie would be considered a fucking classic at this point. There'd be a Criterion Collection version of this movie at
It'd
this
be the
point.
catch me if you
Like,
can of old dude taking care of young kid
right?
movies.
I mean, like, in a weird way, that's kind of what Big is, just like turned on its head because he's also a kid, right? But he's done
Yeah.
that movie, right? But imagine if you had Tom Hanks just a little bit older than he was when you were kind of like watching him and he was top of the list in the early 90s, right? But like him and a kid doing some goofy, funny stuff and him being a little bit more bad boy of comedy like he used to be, like coming back to that, this movie would have just been fucking beloved. I think this movie critically really suffers because of a movement specifically against Sandler at this point in his career. Because otherwise, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in this movie that, again, like the oeuvre of like the bad boy of comedy is there because of Sandler, but if you remove him, it doesn't feel like that's the joke anymore. Yes, he is being a bad dad, and that's funny, but right now, a lot of the comedy is so kind of set in like everything that we bring to this movie now that we have an opinion about Sandler, which wasn't there but for Billy Madison, and right, and we kind of weren't sure yet on Happy Gilmore, and then was completely thrown out the window for Wedding Singer because of the kind of movie it was. It caught us off guard. You know, like there's this movie really kind of, it doesn't do enough to stand on its own, and so because of that, it suffers in the shadow of Sandler previously.
I mean, I stand by again that we are told all of these things about the Sonny character that flat out are not supported by what we know about him and how he acts and relates to the world. He's super kind to people. He clearly, here's the big thing that I personally judge on if someone is successful in life. If they can pay their bills and are like happy in some way, right? And it's not like he's borrowing money from Kevin. He's not mooching off of Kevin. He has his own income. And even though he's only working one day a week at the toll booth, he is able to afford his rent
He's not betting
and
his
his
whole life
life.
on the
Yeah,
Celtics game.
exactly.
Like, yeah.
And he's, it's like I said, Sonny Koufax is a man content. And the reason why he's content is because he doesn't feel he has to do anything more to enjoy his life. And then he gets that taste of what it is to be a father, what it is to be all of these other things. And he's like, oh, I thought I was happy, but really I was just content. And now I have found the things that could actually make me happy. Now, again, is that sort of, toxic messaging? A little. Maybe like masculinity is this, especially with the way that everybody treats Sonny
Yeah, no.
throughout
So
the movie.
I think now is the time to address really like the big thing about this movie is the father-son relationship and how imperative that is to growing up. And that is a really dangerous message, especially in like the 90s, in that like the idea of the absent father, which is one that is often present problematically in a lot of like racial stories and things like that. And like the fact that this movie is leaning so hard into how important this relationship is in order to like to form yourself as a human is like is if I was not in the stable household that I was when I watched this movie and to this day am and watch this film, the relationship I have with my father is healthy and like enjoyable and celebratory. I don't know if this movie would rub me the wrong way if I saw it in any other way, right? Like that's actually really kind of upsetting. Like and then to think at the time what the stereotypes would have been that this would have been like not aiming at, but kind of like ignoring is like really fucking weird. Like there's not a there's first of all, there's just not a lot of like African American people in this movie, period. The one that I can think of off the top of my head is the one that then is used as the butt of a racist joke by Steve Buscemi's homeless guy character in the courtroom scene at the end. Like, it's really weird.
He is, as far as I could tell, one of three ethnic characters in this film. The other one is Julian's first friend in at school, and the last one is the guy who owns the second restaurant that Julian takes a piss on.
Yeah, no,
Where,
we're not counting Schneider in this
no,
group.
I don't count Schneider in that group because he's a stereotype meant to poke fun at a certain type of character, the immigrant in New York. But that guy, I mean, that second guy in the turban, where he's like, "Yeah, it's your problem now." The fact that like you won't use my, let my kid use your restroom, like he's one of the only people of color who appears in this film,
Yeah.
and it's noticeable,
Yeah.
and it I mean it speaks to the types of films that Adam Sandler was making in the 90s.
But part of it also speaks very importantly to his privilege. He
Yeah.
clearly, as we know outside of this movie and everything since and before this movie, he clearly has a great relationship with his father. His relationship with his father is so important that his father, who has now passed, is in his literal production slide at the start of every film that has Happy Madison production in front of it, right? So
Terrific.
like so so this idea being that like he is coming from a very good relationship with his father, making this movie about how important relationships with fathers, and that's great and all, but there is like no acknowledgement in this movie of like some people who have much healthier relationships staying away from their dads or possibly never knowing their dads. Like the fact that this movie just kind of really sells this message can definitely be a dangerous one with the wrong person in your audience.
Yeah. I mean, there's also that scene where he like realizes that he's going to still be responsible for Julian, where he comes to the like, fathers just mess a kid up, so I'm going to let you make the decisions, right? 'Cause you know how you want to live your life. And there's the goth guy who's walking, he's like, "Look at this guy." And he attacks him. He's like antagonistic to a stranger in the park. And then it's okay because at the end he helped that guy realize that all of his anger and like antisocial behavior stems from the fact that he's mad at his father.
Did he convince that guy if that's what's wrong, or did some dude in an ADR booth somewhere say that line? Because it sure as fuck didn't come out of that
It
guy's
might have
mouth.
been Brie Larson, because she is involved in the ADR loop for this particular film.
Weird.
Thank you, IMDb. Yeah, it's like that moment is really strange. And then also thinking about the moment in the courtroom, which just like blink and you miss it. Mr. Herlihy, the old guy, the old drunk guy from the Blarney Stone, when everybody is calling their fathers, bows his head in prayer, which is just like, oh, okay. He's calling his dad in heaven.
Yeah, man, I
Yeah,
didn't
it's
even.
just like, oh, all right. I was sitting there watching a movie. And I'm like, should I call my dad and tell him I love him? Like, that
Yep.
was a real thought. And then I'm like, oh, I told him I love him this morning when I left the house for work, and it's probably going to be like the fourth thing out of my mouth when I get back home today. I think I'm good. I think I don't have that damaged relationship that this movie is trumpeting and championing as like the problem with the youth males of the world at this time, Gen
Well, but
X,
then what you're
like.
supposed to do is you're supposed to rest assured in your privilege that you have this great relationship with your family, that you're supposed to rest in that with like that smugness of knowing that you are not in those positions, right? So like this movie either implies you need to fix your relationship with your dad or celebrate the one that you have. And again, that's great, but that
But
ignores that
there's a whole,
there is a
yeah.
whole other option in this world, and for some people it's not an option that it also like there's a lot going on there that we're not going to be able to unpack as two people that are just not in those situations, but like would be remiss to not acknowledge it like this movie does.
No, I do. I appreciate that you brought it up because I'm like, I don't know how we approach that. I'm pretty sure Seijin has a good relationship with his father. I don't want to start the show being like, so you and your dad, everything okay there? Right? Because if it's not, I'm gonna pick in your brain.
Yeah, no, it's a wild way to like kind of really look at what's going on in this movie, but it's very easy to see how this movie is comes from a place. And you know, we talk about in some of his later films how he really starts to get a very kind of disconnected in small ways, right? Like where like he'll talk about like just, you know, we're gonna go to Hawaii with no concept of like what that actually means
He
to pay
goes to
for.
Hawaii without a hotel reservation.
Like
What the fuck is that?
right. So like that kind of weird disconnect that he has, or we're supposed to believe he's a blue collar character, but then he behaves in a certain way that just seems unreasonable, and we chalk it up to the fact that he hasn't been blue collar for 20 years, right? I think this is kind of the first signs of him not being as open to the rest of the world, maybe, you know?
Yeah. And that's actually really interesting when you consider 2 years earlier with The Wedding Singer, how like a big part of the Robbie Hart character is this realization that like, hello, like you need money to live.
Yeah.
Like Linda didn't want to be with me because I would be making $60 a week at my job.
Right.
And otherwise I'm getting paid in meatballs. Like it is. Like, you can almost see that kid who was crashing on his friend's couch doing prank calls. Like, it's... Like, please just punch that someone noticed him from MTV. It's, yeah, it's crazy to think that that disconnect happens as early as 1999 for
I mean,
him.
But maybe that's what it is, right? Is we this is not the first time we have pointed out that this kind of seems to be the movie where you really start to see a lot of the break, not just in the ways in which audiences reacted to this movie, because this movie did gangbusters, but we do see that the critics are just not having it, and that starts to be the story for the rest of his career with these types of movies. Like, obviously, he does have his critical darlings, but then those don't always do great with audiences depending on what they want to come and see him for, right?
Well, speaking of critical darlings and all that, I had a discussion. I went out to breakfast with some people earlier this week, and you know, talking about the Adam Sandler podcast, Big Daddy comes up, and then Uncut Gems comes up, and we've just celebrated that film, right? That was one of the films we celebrated in June. And also The Hustle, and first of all, none of them had seen The Hustle, but they had heard good things, which that makes me happy that there's still, it's no longer in the top 10 on Netflix, but check out The Hustle if you still haven't and you're listening to the show. But then all of them were kind of down on Uncut Gems. And that like surprised me to hear that as the reaction from it. Cause I hadn't never really spoken with somebody who didn't on some level enjoy that film.
Yeah, it's the natural ebb and flow of these things, right? Like, they get really popular, and then somebody decides that they're going to be the ones to start shitting all over it, and sure enough, they've got four friends that do. I mean, there's that movie is definitely kind of going through that small phase now, but I think that movie's going to stand the test of time, no worries. Like, that's just, it's going to have to get over this hump of just being, what, 3 years old at this point?
Yeah, 2019, so yeah, 3 years old.
Yeah, and then give it 5 years, and suddenly it'll be back to everybody's top ten. So.
Right, but I mean, you bring up Criterion Collection and all that situation, and like that does still happen. Of course, everybody still loves Hubie Halloween. Everybody's in love with Hubie Halloween. So like, we hitched our horse to the right buggy. And that started the travels.
We talked about this even in the episode, but it has the benefit of being a holiday movie. Like, you just kind of can't deny that. But yeah, so you have kind of this being the movie where I think we've really struck gold on what kind of is the point where he also then starts to lose kind of some disconnect with his audience and not being sure. Like, he starts to kind of put on a little bit of a monkey show for the next few movies in like, is this what you want to see from me? Like, tell me what you want from me. Like, kind of is the entire feeling of Little Nicky, as much as we loved that movie. Like, it is entirely him being just like, just tell me what you want. Like, I am a clown, I will dance for you.
Little Nicky being the film that it is, in terms of like, there are boobs on Kevin Nealon's head, and it being a more R-rated affair than everything that came before, also feels very reactionary to the PG-13 and those critical things being like, he's supposed to be this bad boy of comedy, but like, he's so neutered in this film. He's not swearing. I mean, there are a lot of middle fingers in this movie. Like, that surprised me that it still was PG-13. Different world in Hollywood in 1999 is what I'm going to chalk that up to. But it is one of those situations where, like, oh, you think I'm neutered because I'm doing, like, the movie with the kid? Then I will do Little Nicky, and I will show you how bad I can be. And also, I will reference everything that I have done prior to this. I never really considered Little Nicky to be reactionary to a response to a film. It felt more like, all right, at this point, these are the things that people liked. Let's put them back in the movie.
That's reactionary to just his whole career is what it is. Yeah.
But right, exactly. I thought it was reactionary to his career, right? Being at a point in his life where he's like, I'm not sure what works for people, so let's put it in and then maybe try to parse it out. But it also now feels to me, especially after living in this film for the past week, a reactionary statement after Big Daddy. Especially, Big Daddy's so small, and Little Nicky is so large with the effects and the settings and just everything about the film. I mean, literally heaven and hell.
Yeah, I know. Right? Earth, heaven, and hell are explored in that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So I guess now's the time, right? We've been putting it off long enough. Caesar, are you putting this one in the universe?
I mean, I think it fits. We talked about how we have all of the friends that show up. There is a female figure that is well off without him, doesn't need him, but still is there and betters him in a lot of ways. I mean, there's the whole family aspect of it. Like, we just talked about that for 20 minutes. Like, there's a lot of those beats that it hits. And I'll be damned if there isn't magic in this movie, because if there's not, what the fuck was any of the legal bullshit in the last 20 minutes of the movie? None of that was real. Like, the amount of nonsense legalese in this movie that is used to justify things is magical.
First of all, Steve Brill apparently loves lawyers, right? See the Mighty Ducks.
I forgot we talked about like Steve Brill like showing up in the movie, and then
Yeah.
like the same with Tim Hurley playing the kangaroo. Like, these
Exactly.
guys that we've talked about behind the camera for Sandler before, like being in front of the camera now.
Yeah. Also, Dennis Dugan having
Yep.
two cameos, being the Halloween guy, but also being in the episode of Columbo is just incredible. Like, it's just fun. Like, what the hell? Yeah, so all that. But the reason why I would do it, right? Everything that you've cited so far is very good. Teddy Castellucci from Steve, as Steve Brill's character, Teddy Castellucci, he just does not give a fuck. And it is so indicative of just how the government, like, I don't know if it's a statement for Sandler or anything like that, but his feelings about the government, if you were using this as the evidence, can really be parsed out in terms of the fact that the government doesn't actually care. They just pretend to care for the power. And also, like, you need to have good people in government if you want anything to work out for you, which is something that, like, Arthur Brooks represents. That's a whole big deal. But the reason why I would put it in there goes back to That's My Boy. And it's not just the fact that this is clearly the movie that started him saying, "That's my boy," in almost every fucking movie. I would also not be surprised if That's My Boy was a working title for this film, considering how often he refers to Julian as
My
boy.
boy,
Yeah. Which I was like, I have a friend in life who calls his kid boy, and I now realize it is based off of Adam Sandler's performance in Big Daddy.
not God of War. It was not a more recent thing.
What was that?
God of War, God of War 4. Like, that's the
No,
joke
it's
with
the
that. Like,
tone. It's the
four.
tone. The tone is the boy that Adam Sandler says to Julian in this movie.
Nice.
And it was like, "Oh my God, secret unlocked. I now understand you a little bit better." But it is the fact
You know nothing, boy. Sorry.
that in That's My Boy, the only person who sees through all of the literal absurdity that exists in this universe is the judge. And Judge Healy in Big Daddy has the same superpower. The ability to just be like, "This is all absurd. This whole fucking movie, you have been committing fraud against the state and city of New York. There need to be consequences. You came to court today trying to get the custody of this child, and you basically, under oath, admitted to a bunch of crimes that you've been committing over the last 6 weeks.
Not
I
least of
am
which is
holding
kidnapping the
you. I am
child.
holding you in custody until we can figure out what the punishment is for that." Like, it is just one of those moments where it was that moment where I'm like, "Oh, maybe Big Daddy should have been a villain movie." Because Sonny Koufax breaks the law for 80% of this film. And
No,
it's
and then in the end is a celebrated lawyer.
just.
No, I like I said, there's definitely got to be some magic behind whatever the fuck is going on in this movie, because otherwise, like, things just happen in this movie, as they do in these family style films, where, like, you just yeah, because that is the happier ending, we're gonna allow this. Yes, it's ridiculous, but it makes us feel good. Like, it's very much every time the scene changes in this movie.
Right. And I also, as much as magic exists, right, I think the devil exists. And that's why Christy Swanson, for her kind of selfish reaction to the Sonny of it all, like, she should have broken up with him. The whole, "I'm going back home to think about what I want to do," and then coming back with a new boyfriend. Like, there's a lot to be explored in the Vanessa character. First of all, thank God she wasn't given a last name, or like this movie would just like get to show me that hand stamp and welcomed into the club, probably the VIP section of the club where we sit, the six that established our cinematic universe.
I would say that the only reason this didn't end up in the first season is because there was not a double name anywhere.
That's exactly why.
Other than that, this probably would have been first season material for me, to the point where I think it would have established some of these earlier rules. Right now, it's just reinforcing them all.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's any major rules that it necessarily creates, except for maybe the sentimental, like, saccharine nature of it. But even that, I don't think is a hard and fast rule. I just think that that's more just like, if this is present, that's a good sign that you're in the right place.
But no, Devin Decker had to go with the actual Christopher Columbus-directed Pixels as number 5 in season 1. Look what I did, CJ.
I know, and I think
look
that
at
was
the palace
better...
I've built.
No, yeah, and I think that that was the right choice, right? I think that movie, this movie walked so that movie could run, right? Like, that's the deal.
Beautiful. But it is, like, her character, she just wants to be taken care of. She wants a boyfriend who can provide for her, and realizing that Sonny only really wants to provide for himself, like... That's why she then goes out and seeks an older man. The whole father figure stuff that's there, where he's like, what do you want, a father figure? Cut your hair. Like that whole reaction to it. And the fact that she actually, she's some hot shit, but she's a party planner in 1999, before that was like the big ticket job that it eventually would become, is really strange.
I mean, she is as immature as
him. So, yeah.
As him. I think that's the bigger thing that kind of gets lost in this film, is that they are both immature and should not be together because they are both immature and cannot. Somebody has to grow up in the relationship. And so, and she chooses to ghost him, essentially. And that's not great because she is immature, for sure. But somehow she never learns her lesson. Like, I like to think maybe later on she does. And we're meant to believe that she never learns her lesson because of the job at Hooters at the end and all that stuff. Yeah. So
she tries to fast track her maturity by getting involved in a relationship with a mature person.
Right.
And then what we see with the morality play aspect of this Adam Sandler, which would also firmly planted in the universe, is the fact that there are no shortcuts to solving your problems.
She doesn't grow up herself. She thinks just by dating somebody who's grown up, she'll just get it. And that's not how it works. Yeah. Exactly. Again, I want to make it clear, I don't agree with everything that we just said. Some of it. But I don't agree with everything that was about this stuff. As we pointed out, I think her character is probably one of the worst treated in the film.
Right. And yeah, I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just saying that's also part of the story.
Right.
While she is poorly treated, it doesn't stop the fact that she is on the same level of maturity as Sonny, and rather than try to address that or break the toxic relationship that is just informing it for both of them, she decides, well, if I date an older guy, I'll mature with him.
And not tell Sonny what's going on.
Exactly.
Like, she plays games with him too. Yeah.
It's just... Like, everything that happens to her, there is a justification in the film. Or at least they attempt it.
There are reasons, not excuses.
There you go. I like that. All right, so welcome, Big Daddy, to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Kind of not surprising, but I am glad that we got to talk it through, because there were moments where I'm like, maybe it's a little bit too sentimental. Maybe it just, like, veers that tiny bit off course. But no, you have convinced me, based on all the evidence provided, that it should be there. So welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, Big Daddy. Enjoy your complimentary t-shirt. Avoid Eric Gordon. He's a bit of a dick. All right. And if you're like Sijin, the Sprouse brother who's still acting is Cole. He plays Jughead in Riverdale.
Okay.
I can't tell them apart in this movie. Like, there's no moment where I'm like, oh, that's Dylan and that's Cole. I thought, like, that might be fun for note-taking. And then I'm like, no, they're Julian. And it's super impressive that they play one character so
well. It's almost like Disney rode that wave for a long time.
I mean, like, how awesome is that, too, that, like, this kicks that off? The whole, we worked with Adam Sandler, and then we're going to become Disney critical darlings, only for him to then swoop in and save them from the evil mouse factory. All right. So that's it. So thank you so much for joining us for Big Daddy. We're gonna finish this one up by letting you know the movies that we're going to follow up with. This one is for the fans. So Sijin and I, we've been pounding the pavement. We've been talking to people. And we have decided, you know, the movies that we're going to follow up on. And one of them, as Sijin, like, lovingly put, is probably going to take some prep for people, most of all himself and myself. So what we're doing next month, August of 2022, the movie you want to watch to make sure that you're keeping up with us is You Don't Mess with the Zohan.
And a lot of prep involved in that movie. No, that's not the one we were talking about.
Well, especially, you want to make your hair look good, right? No, it is one of those movies that has to be covered. And as Seijin says, he always, he forgets.
You're just kind of giving away your hand there, but yeah.
No, I don't know that. It's like, that's what people bring up when they say it. It's like, well, you got to cover Zohan, right? And I'm like, oh, yeah. And then as Seijin points out, you kind of forget about it. So it is one that we're reminded about by the fans. So that's why we're not going to be messing with the Zohan in August. And then in September 2022, we are going to tackle Reign Over Me. And that comes from a lot of these conversations that I've had. Specifically, I'll shout out Justin at the Hold Up podcast, bringing it up as his favorite Adam Sandler film. And him not being the only person to bring up Reign Over Me as a film. that we should look at, not just as a film, that sounded weird, but as a film that we should examine for a shared cinematic universe. And I think it'll be interesting, especially when we talk about a lot of the themes that make a film part of our personal cinematic universe that we've so far been putting together.
Yeah, it's going to be a ride, guys. I mean, for anybody that's not aware, the reason that we're bringing it up now is it's the September 11th movie that he did. I mean, like, it seems like everybody at that time kind of had theirs, and this is his, him and Don Cheadle, yeah. Right? Like, so we're gonna explore that movie, guys, and just, you know, I trigger warning now, and I will say it next month, and I will say it when we start that episode. Like if it's not something you want to talk about, I like, totally get that, but we'd be not doing our due diligence to just ignore that film, especially because of the fact, like Devin said, it's one that is brought up a lot.
Yeah, because and we'll see why eventually. But yes. Then that's the nice thing, right? Like, those are ones that we went out, we did the research, we spoke to fans, we were harassed by family at reunions, or, you know, just in correspondence we got via emails. Listen to the new episode. When you gonna do Zohan, Dev? so that's why those are the ones that decided. But right now we are opening it up to you. If there is a movie that you think needs to be covered and you can't believe that it hasn't been covered up to this point on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, let us know on Twitter. We're at the ASCU, or send us an electronic mail, as Whitey is so willing to call them at the end of it. To Adam Sandler CinematicUniverse @gmail.com. We want to hear from you. We want to make sure that this season 4 is truly for the fans. Now, do we have some plans in place already? So it might mean that your film is not necessarily chosen. Unfortunately, yes. And again, I hope you have your cork boards and you're trying to figure out the overarching theme of the show. But we do want to hear from you. Let us know those films that you are interested in having us explore. Because I'm looking forward to exploring them for you, right? I'm really looking forward to Zohan.
I maybe I'll remember it when I see it.
And there you go. If you have enjoyed what you've heard here today at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, Seijin and I also do another podcast. That one is focused more on everything, and that is called The Say Report. It's available wherever podcasts are generally found, and new episodes of that release every Monday. And if you want to get in touch with Seijin specifically and maybe try to jog his memory about You Don't Mess with the Zohan, he can be found on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you were there in 1977 when the McDonald's breakfast went national, you can hit up Devin at Devin D. Decker to tell him what that was like.
I'd love to hear it. You know what I started today off with for the first time ever? A hot cakes and sausage.
Nice. Hotcakes were introduced much later.
But that's what Sonny orders. And then is told, no, you're late. And also, I attempted to summon Steve Buscemi, and I have to report it was unsuccessful, but I left out a sausage McMuffin and hash browns for him. But he did not come running, as I thought, man. Might be the way they continue to get Steve Buscemi to be in these Adam Sandler films.
How did they do it? How did they get Steve Buscemi?
I really thought it was a sausage McMuffin and hash brown, based upon the fact that that's how we got the testimony from him. But we may never know, right? That might be the great unsolved mystery of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. But we've talked long enough. Again, thank you for listening. And just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.